an open hearing.
Okay, thank you for coming today.
Did you open the hearing on the PRP?
So we're going to open up a public hearing on 3605.
Thank you for having us today. My name is Ray Thomas, and to my right, your left, is Max Woodbury. And we are here today, Senator Durfler, to talk to you about House Bill 3605, which is the bill that would make changes in the employer liability law. And I'm going to give you a few comments, and then Max Woodbury will be here to tell you about his contact with this law and what it's done in his life, and then we'll be available for any questions that you may have.
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to introduce myself to Senator Starr. I believe I'm one of your constituents. I live on a farm in Blooming, and your area was actually involved in our case because the employer in Max Woodbury's injury is from Gaston. So we're sort of a Tualatin Valley group here. In this case, or this bill was on the House side, there was a considerable amount of talk about the $11.5 million verdict that happened up in Portland last summer. And so when I heard about it, I thought that perhaps the best way for you to hear about it was to talk to the people who were involved in it. So I think that maybe as an example of how the law works and the effect that this change on the law would have in terms of the way that Oregon business is concerned in regard to workers' injuries, maybe this case can serve as an example that will provide you with some illustration. I can tell you that I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I represent people who are involved in construction accidents. That's what I do for my job. Almost 95% of those cases involve underlying workers' compensation claims, and we call a practice like mine a third-party practice. I also know that Senator Starr has some personal experience with this in being a general contractor. And in this case, I think Max's case, there are some things about his injury which show the important role that the ELA provides in compensating Oregon workers after catastrophic injuries. You can see that Max wheeled his way in here in his wheelchair. He's a C5, cervical 5 level quadriplegic. He's actually a geologist who went to work for a subcontractor out of Gaston, which was an excavation contractor on a large remediation project under the supervision of a general contractor, CH2M Hill, which I believe is pretty well known in our state. What happened was an unusual accident in that Max was tearing down a platform. No fall protection had been taught to him or to his boss. He fell 11 feet, and by an accident of nature, he landed in such a way that he partially severed his spinal cord and is now paralyzed from basically the upper chest down. Fortunately, he has limited use of his hands and arms. His employer had workers' compensation coverage, which during the course of Max's life is going to pay out about $4.5 million for the special services that he will need as a quadriplegic. If there were not an Employer Liability Act, it would stop there. The maximum benefits that Max Woodbury would get when his life are what would be provided to him under the Workers' Compensation Act. It's because of the Employer Liability Act that Max Woodbury could seek full compensation, including pain and suffering damages, including compensation for the money that he will never make as a geologist for his injuries. And this is something that I hope that everybody knows, if not from their personal life and their personal business, by the end of this hearing. What happened in Max's case is that his employer from Gaston ended up getting stuck under the workers' compensation law with a $4.5 million workers' compensation claim in a situation where on the job site what led to his accident was a combination of a number of factors involving not only his responsibility, but also the responsibility of his employer and the responsibility of the general contractor. We filed on Max's behalf what is called an Employer Liability Act lawsuit, which went to trial last summer in Multnomah County. CH2M Hill had contracted with Reynolds Aluminum, the owner of the land where the remediation project was occurring, to provide workers who were trained to do the job that they were supposed to do in accordance with the rules in effect on the date of the accident. Now, I'm not here to make anybody be a culprit in Max's accident, but I would like for you to know that the ELA provides a strong incentive for general contractors and others involved in hazardous workplaces to come up to knowledge and teach knowledge about the rules. And the evidence at the trial in this case showed that the general contractor did not even have a copy of the Oregon rules on fall protection. And at the trial, what the defense was in this case, and this was a matter of law under Oregon law, the position at trial was that the general contractor in a job site in this state does not have responsibility for providing the sub or the sub's employees with any knowledge or any training of what the Oregon Fall Protection Plan is. That was what their defense was. And you know what the ELA says and what our own Oregon OSHA rules provide about job site safety? Job site safety is a shared responsibility. The worker has a responsibility. The worker's employer has a responsibility. The general contractor has a responsibility. And it was the jury's job to sort this out. In this case, what the jury decided was that the general contractor had not met their obligation on the job site for providing their subcontractor any information about what the Oregon Fall Protection Rules were, and that that was the cause of Max's accident. And that if Max would have been provided with that information, if he would have known what the rules are, that he would have followed it. And so they ended up with the responsibility on this case. Now, you may think, and I have heard some of the things that have been said about the way that the Employer Liability Act plays out in the state, that that provides Max Woodbury, or maybe Max Woodbury's lawyer, with some kind of a windfall. Well, the fact of the matter is that the structure that has existed for ever since I started practicing law 20 years ago works pretty well. In this case, the general contractor was found to be partially responsible. In other cases I've had, they've been determined not to be held responsible. But the $4.5 million that this claim is going to cost the workers' comp carrier is going to be repaid to that workers' comp carrier by the liability carrier for the general contractor. And that is a statutory creature that exists in each and every workers' compensation claim. It's the same thing that results in repayment to your own workers' compensation carrier if one of your employees is out making a delivery somewhere and somebody in a car bangs into them and they have substantial hospital bills. Why should your workers' comp carrier pay for your employee's injuries when some third party comes in and causes that accident? Why should your history score with your workers' compensation insurance reflect that you had an expensive claim when you had nothing whatsoever to do with it? It was some other person's fault. In this case, what happened was that the jury made the determination about the respective contributions to Max's injury. And when the case is concluded, and it's on appeal, when the appeal is concluded, if Max's case is ultimately upheld, what will happen will be that the Gaston subcontractor's workers' compensation carrier will be repaid the money for Max's case. Their history score will show that while they had a serious accident, it was adjudged to be a different contractor's responsibility so that they will not pay the burden for this in the future. The workers' compensation system will have worked to make it so that the party that's ultimately responsible pays, and the party that is not responsible gets repaid for the amount that they paid out to the injured worker. Now, in 3605, if 3605 is the law in this case, I would like to give you an example of how it will be that what is going to happen is that Oregon employers are going to basically have their hands tied behind their backs. And that is this. Imagine a situation where a worker gets hurt. They have huge medical bills under workers' compensation and huge claim costs. Well, for those of you who come from private companies, have you ever heard of the workers' compensation bill having a $500,000 cap so that once you get to $500,000, the worker can't get any more money? No. So what happens is if it's your worker who gets hurt and you sue the responsible third party and there's a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages, what happens is that the third party knows that they are never going to have to pay more than $500,000, but in terms of the workers' compensation carrier, there's no cap on what they pay under the workers' compensation law. It's true they don't pay pain and suffering damages, but, and you need to know this, maybe some of you can ask staffers about this and see if it's not true. The comp system, when it repays, a comp carrier doesn't distinguish between economic and non-economic damages. A jury verdict is total for whatever it is, and that's the sum, economic and non-economic damages, that is available to repay the workers' compensation carrier. If you tie the hands of the way the system is supposed to operate, those non-economic damages are going to be carved out to make less money ultimately available to repay the comp carrier. And that is, I believe, not the way the system was ever designed to work. The other thing is, in our case, we had an excellent general contractor. They had excellent lawyers. And yet those people went into an Oregon jury less than a year ago, and they said when a catastrophic injury happened on their job site, that under Oregon law, under the Employer Liability Act, they did not have responsibility, they didn't have responsibility for providing safety equipment. We agreed with them there. They argued that they didn't have responsibility for even knowing what the Oregon laws were on safety rules for fall protection. Now, that's under the ELA as it existed, and that was not a successful defense in events. It's going to cost them some money. If you further restrict the reach of the ELA, is that the direction that you want to go into? The purported reason for this House Bill 3605 is that general contractors need to know, have some certainty about what their exposure is. Well, the fact of the matter is that in Oregon it always has been, and I would suggest to you it always should be, a matter of shared responsibility on the job site about who's responsible for knowing the law and teaching the working people who need to know the law what it is. If you take the 3605 and you change the Employer Liability Act, what's going to happen is that those workers who are most in need of legal protection, and don't forget, what the ELA applies to are workers who are in high-hazard occupations, people who are climbing, people who are working at height, people who are working around dangerous heavy equipment. Those people who are most in need of protection of the law are going to be hobbled when a disaster occurs and it comes time to go to the courts and to seek redress. So it's obvious what my position is on this, but I want to tell you that my role in the system as a trial lawyer is that when somebody like Max and his family come to me and they talk about what the future is going to hold for somebody in his position, I have to look at the legal remedies that are available. And when I look into the future and I see this guy over in Gaston who's like basically a one-truck subcontractor who's tagged with the complete cost of a $4.5 million claim on a job where they got one of the world's largest general contractors, supposedly an Oregon company, in charge of safety on the job site, it's going to really make me wonder when I have to explain to somebody's parents about how back in 1999, the Oregon legislature decided to give the general contractors a little legal break so that they can duck out a safety responsibility on the job site. That's not going to be something that I want to do, and I hope that that is not what results from this hearing in this case. This is Max Woodbury. He's from Portland, Oregon. He's a geologist. He's now in rehabilitation training to learn an occupation so that he can make the most of his career. He may have a few words to say to you.
Maybe just a few words after that.
I'll just give us your name or the reference if you would.
Yeah, my name is Max LeBerry.
Okay.
And I live in Portland, Oregon. And 3 years ago, I sustained a cervical level spinal cord injury. For me, I'm here because I think it's important for people to know that my injury could have been prevented. I think that workplace safety is very important, and I think that this law, that it, if it gets passed, could even lessen this workplace safety. As far as the importance in the general contractor's mind, and I think I really hope that that's something that doesn't happen, because accidents do happen and they can be prevented, and mine is one of them. So I think that's what else I would like to say. So
if you have any questions for us, we'd be glad to answer.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on Hospital 3605 for a bit and go into Hospital 2431 because we're waiting for some other people to come down. And John Ledger, do you want to come up with Jim Craven? Welcome to the committee meeting. If you'd like to tell us your name and tell us why we need this film, we'd be happy to hear it from you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. Good afternoon. HB 2431 is a bill that we are pleased to bring to you. We've reached agreement with the governor's office. It was a long and arduous process. And I just want to thank Senator Beyer and also Representatives Welsh, King, and Devlin. They were instrumental in getting us through a lot of hoops on this. The bill deals with community right-to-know programs, local programs. A community right-to-know program is one where information is provided to the public regarding some aspect of an industrial activity. There's a federal community right-to-know program that affects all states, and Oregon is one of only four states that have their own statewide community right-to-know program. A couple of years ago, there was a local program initiated in Eugene, primarily in response to Hyundai coming in and opening up a facility there. It was certainly, in our viewpoint, I think in the view of the businesses that are effective, fairly punitive, and it requires things, for instance, as the amount of vinegar that is in baked bread to be reported as a toxic output. It requires things like reporting of certain chemicals over a year down to 22 one-thousandths of a pound, which is impossible, and people have finally just kind of given up on trying to do that. There are penalties of $25,000 a day, which is like, I think, about $9 million a year. Forms a toxic board. Last session, we brought in a bill that essentially preempted local government from conducting these types of programs. It was a very contentious bill. It didn't make it all the way through. We ran out of time. This bill, it's important to realize, is not a preemption bill. But what it does is establish some sideboards on local programs that make them reasonable if somebody wants to implement one. And it also improves the existing state program, so we get a better state program for what we have. The sideboards that I'll touch on just first, and you should have the Dash 8 amendments, which are the, and if you like, would you like to go first, Representative Devlin? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if that's okay, I'll...
Sure, you go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Devlin, House District 24, when this bill was considered in the House, as a member of the House Water and Environment Committee. We considered the bill. The bill, when it first came forward, obviously was introduced in exactly the same bill that was introduced in the last legislative session. AOI, after it was introduced, and I think on plan, came in with amendments to the bill. I thought that those amendments were a move in the right direction, but probably nowhere near close to far enough as I would be satisfied with the bill. I learned that Representative King and Representative Lee Beyer were wanting to push for additional amendments to the bill, and I assisted them in getting those amendments considered at the committee. The bill passed out of the committee on a divided vote, went to the floor, and I think passed by a fairly reasonable margin, 38 aye, 22 no. I was still not satisfied with the bill at that point because my ultimate objective is to get a bill that that both sides, if there's more than two sides, there's probably three or four sides of this issue, find reasonable, and that ultimately can make it through the House and the Senate and the governor could ultimately sign. So I, along with Representative King, have been working behind the scenes to try to make this into a better bill, even a better bill than what came out of the House. Parties that have been part of those discussions, both the two gentlemen to my right and members of the governor's staff, have been reasonably receptive to discussing issues relative to the bill and making reasonable compromises. I think the amendments that they will propose to you today should be amendments that industry will feel comfortable with, and I would hope that members of the environmental community would take a look at them before they judge those amendments, and to actually look at them from the perspective of what they actually do, not what might be implied that they actually do, because I think those amendments will be found to be reasonable. I've approached this from the standpoint of being a political pragmatist. The original bill that failed only due to basically an error, strategic error on the House floor, would have passed in this session in both the House and the Senate. The original bill that was actually a repeal of Eugene's program. The AOI version that they brought in with amendments would have probably passed by a few more votes. The version that Representative King and I put together would pass by a few more votes than that. This version, I think, will pass by a few more votes than that, and I think ultimately, at this point, we've been assured that the governor will sign the bill if these amendments are passed. And I've approached this from the standpoint that when you look at that, those numbers, we're in a situation where if you wanted to look at this from an environmentalist standpoint, I think you should exercise some pragmatism. A far worse bill could pass this body. It's true today that if it was a bill that was not as good as this bill, the governor would probably veto it. But I know, and the governor knows, that he will only be here another 3 years, and we don't know what the future of who will be the chief executive is. We also don't know what the future balances of these bodies will be relative to these issues, and I'm not talking necessarily partisan. I'm just talking about people's viewpoints on the issues. And I think this is a reasonable compromise between both parties. And I would like very much, just to close by saying that I would hope that environmental interests would take a close look at the amendments that I hope that you adopt today and examine them for what they actually do. And what they actually do is, I think, set up a fairly good structure to allow Eugene's program to continue to exist, to allow other local programs to exist, and to allow the state to start to look more carefully at what the state's role should be relative to this issue.
Okay. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just touch on the sideboards, Mr. Chairman, if I may, quickly. One is having to do with penalties. Under this bill, the maximum penalty would be $1,000 a day for failure to report. These are not emission violations. These are reporting violations. In Eugene now, the maximum penalty is $25,000 a day, which mounts up over time. Under this bill, in Eugene, the penalties would drop when the bill becomes effective in September down to $1,000 a day, the same as it would be everywhere else in the state. Another sideboard has to do with chemical listing, that is, what chemicals are covered. This bill does not specify which chemicals can or can't be covered. Cities can still include any chemicals they want to include, But the difference here is that the lists that the city comes up with have to be put out for public comment as an ordinance, like a rulemaking, so everyone gets to comment on it. We believe that if in Eugene had the situation been where the city had to put out for public comment something that says vinegar in bread has to be recorded as a toxic output, I don't think that would have survived. That simply would not have been gone through the city council. So I think having something like this in place makes sure we have something reasonable. Now, that particular item does not go into effect in Eugene for 4 years under this bill. The third one is fees. Right now, in these amendments, in the Dash 8 amendments, the fees are capped at $2,000 per facility. Right now in Eugene, some facilities are paying up to around $13,000 a year for this program. That cap would kick in Eugene's case after 4 years. So they would still be able to fund the program as they're doing now for 4 years, after which time the statewide cap would apply. Another sideboard is that when you wanted a program like this, a local community, they'd have to go to the state program first and ask if the state would do it for us. That assures some uniformity. And if the state doesn't commit to running the program, getting the information they need for them within 180 days, then the community can go ahead with their own program. So it gives the state program through the fire marshal the first cut at gathering more information if more is needed. Some of the additions to the or improvements to the local program, to the state program, excuse me, that are contained in this, it designates someone within the DEQ as a toxics coordinator. So the DEQ will coordinate their program as it looks at toxics and the other state agencies. One of the recommendations that came out of a governor's task force that this bill would implement is it would make the data appear seamless from the outside. Right now, if you want community rights to know information, you get onto the web page for the fire marshal, but there's an enormous amount of data that's stored in other agencies that is just essentially impossible to get. And what this bill does is say you put together a state committee of kind of techie people, you know, that know how to do this stuff, and you start getting, using the fire marshal's web page as a gateway so everybody can find out what other information is out there. So you'll have a big increase in information that's available to the public simply because it'll be start being put on the web from other agencies like DEQ. Also, one of the recommendations of the governor's task force that we put in here is the affirmative duty to report to the state fire marshal. The state has a community rights know program run by the state fire marshal, but oddly enough, you are not required to report information to the state fire marshal unless he kind of catches you and tells you you have to do it. And what this bill does, this program's been in place for a long time, is say after the year, I think starting 2001, you have an affirmative duty to report information to the state fire marshal, just like any other program. One of the other things the bill does that the task force recommended is that public and private entities get treated the same, as much as provided for by law. So you can't exempt out a city function or a public function unless the law says you have to. I just wanted to stress again, the cities can institute their programs, but this has several sideboards, primarily process that they have to go through. It allows the Eugene program to run with some changes, that is reduction of penalties, for another 4 years, after which time they fall under the state same rules as everybody else. The League of Oregon Cities is neutral on the bill, and we're pleased to say that the governor's office has reached agreement with us on this bill. It also has the support of the Construction Trades Union because they're very interested in economic development of the state. And with that, I'll try to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Chair.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Craven, representing the Oregon Council of the American Electronics Association. In the interest of time, I think Mr. Ledger and Representative Devlin did an excellent job outlining both kind of the political history of the bill and also what the bill indeed does. Just to reiterate that 2431 with the Dash 8 amendments that are before you today allows the Eugene experiment to continue. Even in 4 years, the Eugene Charter Amendment may have to comply with some limitations of state policy, but this I have heard repeatedly over the last few months that this bill repeals Eugene's law. It does not. And that this bill would make it impossible for other communities to have local chemical data collection programs. It does not. And finally, I think the biggest prohibition in the House passed bill that would have admittedly made it difficult to have local programs. The House said no local fees at all. Sort of in the waning hours here, we have a compromise there that says, you know, local fees would be allowable, but a company, a single facility, wouldn't pay more for a local program than they do to support the statewide program. We think that's reasonable. And in the spirit of compromise and getting a bill to the final yes in this building, we do support the -A8 amendments. And we appreciate everybody, members of this body and the governor's staff and the advocacy groups and everybody who's worked together on it, and urge your passage. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have one. I got a little confused in there. The fines, Will Eugene, which is $2,500, stay the same for 4 years or two? Or does that drop down to the $1,000 a day?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, the Eugene penalties right now are a maximum of $25,000 a day.
That makes sense in the wrong place. Okay.
And they would, on passage of this bill, they would drop down to the maximum of $1,000 a day, which, you know, this is for a reporting violation, and that's a daily fine, so it does mount up.
Okay, so everything else in Eugene's law stays intact for 4 years except that piece?
Let's see, that piece changes. Also, the way to enforce the program must be through the local city. Can't do it through third-party citizen suits. And the other part that affects Eugene is that they would have to, and this is statewide, also develop a program whereby a company could come in and get an exemption if it made sense for that to occur. Right now, so they have to have a process so you could come to the city council and say, this doesn't make any sense for me, and the city council would have a way to exempt you out of the program. But aside from that, I believe, unless I missed one, and Mr. Craven may know, I believe those are the only things that go on for 4 years.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Michael Kerrigan, Steve Johnson, and Brenda Kuhn.
Chairman Durfler, members of the committee, my name is Michael Kerrigan. I'm director of Oregon Peace Works, part of the Oregon Conservation Network. And the test line today in opposition to the amendments you're considering today. I also live at 1439 West 4th Street in Eugene. House Bill 2431 makes community toxic reporting expensive and complicated. After a local government has passed a toxic right to know law, for example, after public debate, hearings, et cetera, before there's a program, while the program is still on public funds, the local government must seek and respond to comments from reporting companies on each of the reportable toxic chemicals regarding, A, whether each chemical is a health or environmental risk, and whether it be difficult or costly to the company to tell the public about its use and release of each chemical. That's also on page 3 of the changes you have, line 12. I should say, too, this is, I'm speaking on behalf of Dr. Mary O'Brien today, who is the on the toxics board, and one of the people who wrote the ordinance. So Mary couldn't be here today, so I should have mentioned when I started it, either actually comments from Mary, who very carefully went over the amendments before she went off on her work trip to Eastern Oregon. So this would be very expensive and time-consuming. It requires the local government to have staff that are toxicological experts on each of 1,000 or more chemicals. After a community has gone through a debate and forum process to establish a right to know law, like such as the initiative process in Eugene, a community has to, one, again seek comments from the public, two, seek and respond to comments on the program from numerous state agencies, give the state a half year to decide whether they want to run the program and show that the data they would collect isn't substantially the same as what federal and state agencies currently collect. And under the amendment, that's on page 2, line 1. The local government has established procedures to exempt the company from reporting if the company shows that the toxic it emits pose only a little risk to the public health or environment. And that's on the changes at page 3, line 27, and also in the original bill. It's not 3, section 8, but 3, Section 4, capital A, small b, capital A, page 3, line 19. I'm sorry if I'm causing any confusion. It's hard to keep these straight. Showing that a company's toxic chemicals won't pose more than a little risk is like requiring a local government to prove that throwing one acid battery in a landfill will pose more than a little risk to the public health or the environment. What's key here is that toxic right to know is about cumulative toxics in a community and where small and large contributions to community toxics are coming from. The local government has to place the heaviest burden on small business through a $2,000 cap on the largest company's fee. That's under the amendments, page 1, line 14. So the cap would force small companies, for example, one with the minimum of 10 employees, to pay disproportionately much more than a large company, for example, one with 1,000 employees. A proportionate system, for example, I'll keep going to the last part. And finally, statewide reporting would remain the same under House Bill 2431. The government policy group, including industrial expertise, would merely comment on what they think the state should allow for citizen rights to know. That's the original bill, Section 4, and amendment Section 4, Line 6. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Thank you. Chairman Gerber, members of the committee, my name is Steve Johnson. I was the chief petitioner for the City of Eugene Charter Amendment that created Eugene's toxic reporting law. And I have served on the City of Eugene Toxics Board since its creation. My opposition to House Bill 2431 stems from several concerns. First, I feel that this bill is a thinly disguised attempt to prevent any other community outside of Eugene from creating a toxic reporting law and eventually to prohibit Eugene's law by creating a process that is so burdensome, expensive, time-consuming, and adversarial that no community would successfully negotiate requirements or be willing to take on the financial risk of trying to create a law similar to Eugene. As an example, a community that wants to create a reporting law has to see comments from the public after an initiative or ordinance process, which usually allows public comments to begin with. They then have to seek and respond to comments from DEQ, the State Fire Marshal, and the Health Division, for reasons that are never specified or clear to me. Then give the state half a year to decide whether they want to run the program, and I suppose just know how that would be funded, and then show that the state or federal government doesn't collect substantially the same information, which you'll never get voters to approve unless you can show at the very get-go anyway. After all this tooth jumping, which must be done at public expense, it's an unfunded, essentially, mandate until you get the program in place. No community would imagine doing it. I'd be shocked if any community successfully negotiated this or even attempted to do so. So I think it'd be incredibly unlikely. Second, this bill places a tremendous burden on small manufacturers. Quite a bit's been said about how we fund the program in Eugene and what some manufacturers pay. The reason we've taken that task, and we've made this law actually relatively inexpensive in Eugene, our budget was predicted by our opponents to be about $250,000 a year, now it's down to less than $100,000 a year and shrinking. We charge companies to the best of our ability under state law based on our estimation of the amount of toxic material they release to the environment. We are prohibited by state law from doing this on quantity, so we have taken as a surrogate for quantity the size of the company. And we have found that, in general, small companies emit less toxic material to the environment than large companies. Under this proposed amendment, the most you could charge any company would be $2,000. If companies were to pay for this, it would become an onerous burden on small companies. In addition, you're not allowed, on the face of it, to exempt small companies. In Eugene, we currently exempt any company with 10 or fewer full-time equivalent employees. Now we would have to cover every company, no matter how small they were, and probably charge all of them a $2,000 fee. That's a burden on small companies that I think is absolutely unfair. The cost per employee would be much, much higher than the current Eugene program. Third, this bill does nothing to increase toxic reporting at the state level. It asks that the Committee of State Agency Employees submit a report to the legislature in 2 years on what their ideas are on toxic reporting and how it could be improved at the state level. There's no mandate that this go forward in any significant fashion. And given I think it'd be unreasonable to expect that this would result in an increase in state toxic reporting on the face of it. We'll only get that, I think, with a much more serious attack on this problem. Also, this bill makes
I think, almost impossible for local communities to set local standards. They will have to respond to enormous series of complaints and criticisms about this, as well as interface with federal and state governments at a level that seems unreasonable in the face of Oregon's long tradition that local communities set local standards. Now, a few things that have been talked about I'd like to respond very quickly to. The notion of vinegar. The concern is not whether vinegar goes into bread, but it's whether vinegar goes into water. And right now, we require a balanced reporting. If you use vinegar, which can change the pH in the water and affect fish and also water treatment plants, and that's the reason that it's considered a toxic material, and believe me, there's a finite amount of it you'd want to drink, same for bleach, which has been mentioned in these meetings. The law requires that you say if you use bleach or vinegar, where it goes. If someone goes into bread, fine. I don't think anyone thinks vinegar and bread is a health hazard. If it goes into water, that's another issue. If bleach goes into water, it's a more serious issue. So yes, we require reporting of those things. Every toxic material in Eugene's law, however, is taken from a variety of federal lists that have already tried to establish at the federal level that these materials are toxic. These requirements would require every community to reestablish what the federal government already has, toxic material by toxic material, an impossible burden. In Eugene, we have also shown that our reporting law catches hundreds of chemicals released into the environment that have previously not been reported by community right to know laws, the federal toxic inventory laws, the fire marshal law, or any other law. We've also shown that business can comply with the reasonable law and that a board composed of citizens and industry can harmoniously oversee this law. We've done this without contentious meetings, without large expense, and with no industry complaints. We've never at the board had an industry come forward and complain about the law. Yes, the law in Eugene allows maximum fines of $25,000 a day. We have so far adjudicated 8 cases of failure to report in a timely fashion. In one case, a fine of one day at the minimum of $250 was levied. Under Eugene's law, the way it is, a fine in beyond the minimum could only be leveled if industry representatives agreed to that fine. I think it's extremely unlikely a large fine would ever be levied. In addition, that $25,000 maximum fine is not out of line with other state laws. Finally, I'd like to say that I think community right to know is essential, that toxic reporting is good for public health, it's good for the environment, it's good for business. People may remember that 2 years ago, one of Eugene's largest employers said they would leave Eugene if this bill stayed on the books. Today, that company still practices its business in Eugene, it complied with the law, and in one public forum claimed that the law had actually saved them some money by making them aware of the loss of toxic materials. We've seen no evidence that this is an impossible law, difficult to comply with, but we have seen evidence that it gives the public information they didn't previously have. I urge you to vote against it. Thank you very much.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Chairman Dreffler, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brandon Kane, and I'm here with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'm representing 25,000 citizen members across the state. I serve as a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which works to promote environmental quality, consumer protection, and political reform. The bill you're considering today contradicts our positions in all these areas. It would undermine pollution prevention, prevent consumers from obtaining the information they need to protect their health, and discourage citizen participation in the political process by overriding the will of the voters of Eugene. For all these reasons, we urge you to oppose House Bill 2431. I'd like to know laws that help other states reduce chemical use, prevent pollution, and protect public health. A study in Massachusetts found that the state's Toxic Use Reduction Act helped reduce toxic chemical waste by 30% since 1990, saving Massachusetts businesses over $90 million. Similar reductions in savings were found in studies in New Jersey. As a Eugene resident, I can tell you firsthand that after the first full year of implementation, the Eugene Toxic Right to Know has been a success. All companies bound by the Charter Amendment were able to comply with the requirements. Despite dire predictions made during the 1996 election campaign, no Eugene business bound by the Charter Amendment was forced to leave the city or suffer financial hardships. In fact, the low cost of the program should serve as a model for other communities and the state. The residents of Oregon's second largest city are able to access the toxic reporting data with only one full-time worker on the payroll and without spending any tax dollars. Unfortunately, this version of House Bill 2431 eliminates any possibilities for communities to craft their own rights in the law in a manner acceptable to their residents and businesses. House Bill 2431 forces communities to adhere to complex, time-consuming, and costly processes that adds bureaucratic red tape to relatively simple tasks. These costs will not only be disproportionately passed on to small businesses in the community, but to the taxpayers as well. This will only serve to diminish any opportunity for local communities to work with local businesses in creating innovative, cost-effective, and mutually beneficial means of reporting use of hazardous substances and replace it with procedural wrangling, contention for exemptions, and litigation. Businesses would be allowed to ask for an exemption to reporting based on the vague standard that its operation poses, quote, little and quote, risk to the public health and environment. This misses the whole point of rights and no laws, to allow individual citizens to access information that allows them to make the decisions as informed consumers, since it's still not certain what effects various chemical combinations have on human health and the environment. Months were spent in public deliberations before the November 1996 election on the benefits and drawbacks of Eugene's proposed Toxic Rights to Know initiative. House Bill 2431 would not only undermine the outcome of that election, circumventing the will of the voters of Eugene, but also reduce options available to other communities, smaller communities, citizens, in passing their own rights to know law. Although a recent poll by the Chemical Manufacturing Association showed that 90% of all Americans believe that it is their right to know what toxins are used in their communities, House Bill 2431 would make such a right to know laws virtually unworkable. Because of this, the governor has previously stated that he won't sign a bill that restricts community rights to know law without better reporting at the state level. Fortunately, House Bill 2431 does precisely that. It obstructs the cost-effective development of community rights to know laws, while provides no mandate for reporting at the state level. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just find this discussion interesting. I mean, in this building, we get all of the arguments of local control, and it's funny how each party divvies out what they deem to be important for local control and those things which they deem important for state control. And since we're talking about local control involving public health, I'd just like your reaction to there are members of the Senate and of the House as well who believe that abortion is a public health issue. And how would you feel about also allowing local control over abortion rights and abortion access? Because that is a public health issue, and I did hear public health just come up. And you may think it's a little off the track, but I truly don't believe it is, because we keep arguing this issue of local control, and it's a matter of convenience, and I'm tired of it becoming a matter of convenience.
Well, I'm going to take this first. Of course, I would disagree with you on abortion as a public health law, right? Primarily and fundamentally, it's a human rights issue, not a public health issue. But having said that, the question is, if the state does not do if the state does not do an adequate job of providing information in this case about toxic materials, should local communities have the right to do that? If the state did an adequate job, would any local community want to? And I suspect that no local community would want to put itself through what Eugene has put itself through if the state did that. So if the state passes a law that's so superior, no community wants to do that, I'm fine with that. It will matter very little to me. What's most important is that we get reporting of the release of toxic materials to the environment. Issues of local control, I agree. Everyone has taken and carved out their niche on that. And traditionally, the Republican Party has opposed big government. Now we could argue the Republican Party is supporting big government by wanting to overthrow local control. And there's a variety of those issues before the legislature. So I think that's question you could ask yourself just as much as you ask me. But I think the real issue and the reason we have a Georgia Constitution is to allow local communities the option, if existing law at either the federal or state level does not provide the protection that they feel they need or the information they need, then they have what we think of Oregon as an inalienable right to go ahead and do that. And that's why I support local control in this case.
Could I follow up? Now, when it comes to State Endangered Species Act, when it comes to water quality, especially water quality impaired streams, it seems to me interesting that I hear many a time that DEQ really does quite a sufficient job, and we do not want the federal government stepping in necessarily because DEQ is handling this. I personally at times have believed DEQ has done a wholly inadequate job, and perhaps it would be better for the federal government to step in. But the thing is, here we are, I think almost, it concerns me, giving DEQ additional authority and asking them to come up with additional programs in terms of dealing with toxic substances, so that this is a statewide issue. Now, when we test water quality samples, that is done at the state level. The standards are set either at the federal level or at the state level. They are not set at the local level. How is it that you could argue that whether or not we are ensuring that our people are getting safe drinking water when we aren't having local control as to drinking water standards?
I don't think I would necessarily argue that. If people feel that local control is inadequate to their drinking water, then if they can convince voters of that, I'm fine with someone trying to make their local drinking water have a higher standard than what the state has. I think the state does have a reasonable standard for drinking water, and very few communities have passed such a law because most people feel that it is adequate. On the other hand, for air quality, we do have some cases of local control. Where I live, we have Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority that has local control over certain aspects of air quality because we perhaps think that DEQ does not do an adequate job. So, once again, I think it's really case-specific more than it's something that you can set up as a general rule. The only general rule is, well, they should have a right to protect itself if it feels it's not protected well enough.
Oh, I could go on with philosophical discussion all day.
Okay. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you.
So we have Cedric Castillo here. I guess if you want to say something. So you have David Kelly. Did you want to come up with a question? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, Susan Castillo, State Senator for District 20, Eugene. I come before you on House Bill 2431, still expressing the same concerns I did with the earlier version of the bill. This does have a few less restrictions on local government's ability to set up their own right-to-know programs. However, for the community of Eugene, we would just as soon not see a bill. We would like for the state to leave us alone and let our program move forward and let us deal with any of the bumps in the road that we may see as we are implementing our program and let the community work it out, since it is a program that was created by voters. It went to the ballot and the voters in our community said that they wanted to do this. And so once again, while this bill does delay some of the effects that it would have on Eugene, it still does have an effect on Eugene's program, and we would rather that the state not come in and tell us what we can and cannot do with that program. And so that's one concern that I have. Looking specifically at a couple of elements in the bill, I am concerned about the language here in this amendment, reducing our flexibility in how we fund the program. And then also one part of the bill deals with trying to address our state program. And that is another part of my concern here, is that those who have wanted to come in and restrict local communities' programs have been unwilling to also come forward and strengthen the scope of our state program. And so it seems to me that if we're going to tell local governments that we're going to put some restrictions on them, then we really should deliver a program that is sufficient and that does not require communities to go out and try and get more information on their own. And as I look at the amendment here, basically what it does is just help with creating a better database and better access to the information that we already collect. It doesn't really deal with the scope of the program. And that's an exercise that we already went through with the governor's task force on toxics right to know during the interim, and we came up with very similar recommendations that you don't need a bill to do. You can just, the governor could direct the agencies to do some of this work. So, in our opinion, still in Eugene, we don't need to have a bill. Our program is moving forward, and we will be addressing any of the issues that come forward in that program, and the other parts of the bill could be done without legislation. Thank you.
We're going to go about another 10 minutes in this, so if you want to discuss it, I'd appreciate it as quick as possible, please.
Chairman Durfler, members of the committee, my name is David Kelly. I'm a city councilor in Eugene, Ward 4. I'm here today to testify against House Bill 2431, I have some other new team staff present, including the previously mentioned single full-time staff person who can answer any specific questions you may have. On behalf of the City of Eugene, I urge you to oppose any change to Eugene's Toxics Right to Know Charter Amendment that was adopted by our voters in November of 96. The legislature should not substitute its judgment for the duly expressed will of the citizens of Eugene in a matter of vital concern to those citizens. This is inconsistent with our state's longstanding tradition of home rule. 2431 invades the basic right of local self-government. Local governments exist at the will of the people in their community and should be allowed to set community goals and priorities, allocate community resources, and provide for the formulation and implementation of policies that preserve and enhance the quality of their lives. The Eugene Toxics Right to Know Charter provision is a reasonable and appropriate exercise of local self-government. And that control is rooted in the idea that government closest to the people are most responsive to their needs. And the Toxics Right to Know Charter Amendment in Eugene is a perfect example of the will of those local people being expressed. The election campaign was very visible. The electorate was very well informed. It passed with 56% of the votes in 96. And as been previously mentioned, the program is up and running. The first reports were filed in April of this year. The information is available on the Internet, at the public library. In short, it's working. We do not and cannot, as the City of Eugene, support any bill that takes away the ability of the residents of Eugene to dictate what type of toxic reporting program they want. Our voters have already spoken on this matter. They made a decision. The program is operating. And few would argue the program has not been a success, particularly few in Eugene. The latest Dash 8 version of House Bill 2431 will negatively impact Eugene's Toxics Right to Know Charter Amendment. It does not, in spite of what was previously said, allow the Eugene experiment to continue without severe disruption. The bill accomplishes little other than place restrictions and limitations on Eugene's program. To give you two specific examples, first, the proposed amendments place a fee cap of $2,000 per facility, which reduces our flexibility in how we fund the program. Secondly, the proposed amendments mandate an exemption mechanism, and this is on page 3, line 20 of the Angros amendment. That exemption mechanism could place a tremendous burden on local governments to determine whether each operation poses little or no risk, and that is effective immediately, not as of 2003. We suggest that you insert a period after the word secrets on page 3, line 20, and delete the clause where the local government determines that the operations of the entity pose little or no risk to the public health or the environment, end quote. Without these suggested changes, local government is faced with significant ambiguity. The city government of Eugene, my city council, would be placed in a very awkward and ultimately impossible position of determining matters of little or no risk and what constitutes reasonable. And the Toxics Right to Know is not about determining risk at the local level. It's about giving the public the raw information on toxic substances in their community. City of Eugene urges this committee to respect the rights of local governments provided by the Oregon Constitution to exercise local control over local responsibilities. We have the means necessary at the local level to deal with issues surrounding our Toxics Right to Know program. We don't need state intervention. For example, a toxics board with strong business representation is currently considering a revision of our fee structure to comply with the recent court decision. I ask you to protect the rights of city residents to determine the contents of their city charters and to protect the rights of local governing bodies to enact ordinances and procedures relating to all aspects of local government. Protect our proud tradition of local self-government and do not change our voter-approved charter amendment. Do not support House Bill 2431. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you for testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I just very briefly do the time restraint that we have. I just want to make certain that the committee understands that the process of the voters in approving this was not one that was referred to the voters by City Council. This was an initiative.
Why don't you tell us who you are?
I apologize. Fred Brzezinski, State Representative of District 40, takes in part of South and East Eugene, as well as some of the greater area of the south of the city. My concern is to make certain that people realize that the vote that was cast by the voters was not one that was referred by the City Council. It was one that it was truly a grassroots initiative that went out to the people.
got the support of the people before it even went to the ballot. And at the time that it went to the ballot, as City Councilor Kelly has said, it was in fact fully debated before the vote, and the results speak for themselves. My concerns with the current version of HB 2431 also include the establishment of a task force. As the, Senator Castillo said, that was already took place last time during the interim period. The governor put a task force together, and I would say that we've been there, we've done that. They were not able to reach any agreement that was amenable to the parties in at the table, and so we're here today, and they're asking for you to overturn what was attempted to be overturned in 1997. One of the guidelines, my understanding from the governor's office, is that if there's going to be any type of limitation placed on a local community to introduce any type of toxic rights, no, on a local level, that the state program was going to have to be enhanced, and that it was going to allow for improvements on a statewide basis to deal with whatever limitations that were going to be placed on local control or local communities to incorporate such programs. My understanding from the current version that's before you today, it has not enhanced that state program, and I would object to it for that reason as well. Lastly, being a representative, and I would consider myself one of the senior representatives due to term limits for the city of Eugene, I do find a lot of uncomfort that when we ever have an issue that comes before this body, when it deals with that city or any other city as to their local control, and I ask each and every one of you, if your community was faced with this type of legislation, where would you be, and would you think it is appropriate for your communities to have their say, their citizens, to be overridden at a higher level when there's no justification for that? Be willing to attempt to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Questions? Okay. Thank you
for your time.
Thank you. If you just have a minute quicker. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 2431, and we're going to get back to the city panel. Okay, we're going to reopen the public hearing at 3605. And let's see who we have. Jim Westwood. And Betsy Earls, you want to come forward, please? Thanks for the coming.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Westwood. I'm a partner in the law firm of Miller Nash, a firm that represents several contractors and property owners, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3605. I apologize that I haven't been here for the full testimony on 3605, so I've had to get some of this secondhand, but I have heard what was said earlier today, and I've also looked at the letter that came to you, Senator Driffler, from the governor's office, the governor's legal counsel, describing the governor's concerns about 3605. I think there are some misconceptions and, frankly, some mistaken information about 3605 out there. The current Employer Liability Act, which 3605 would slightly amend, predates the Workers' Compensation Law. The ELA was adopted in 1911, 2 years before there was workers' compensation in Oregon. At the time, a worker had a claim only against his or her own employer, and only for negligence, and the doctrine of contributory negligence meant that if the worker, even if slightly negligent, would be barred of all recovery. The ELA sought to change that, and it did. 2 years later, we had a workers' comp law, and in 1965, of course, workers' comp was made mandatory in the state of Oregon as well. So things have changed quite a bit since 1911. The current Employer Liability Act is essentially a strict liability act. An owner or general contractor is essentially strictly liable for unlimited damages if he or she participates in activity which causes injury or death to a worker. The question is raised by the governor's office, well, and by others as well, don't we want to encourage safety in the workplace? Of course we do. And
The current ELA, I submit, actually discourages that. The amendment to the ELA would take away the incentive, which now exists, for a general contractor or a property owner to look the other way and not participate in providing a safe workplace. There would be more, I think, incentive to participate in providing a safe workplace if an owner or contractor knew that there was not this strict liability if you had anything at all to do with the workplace. Rather, if the common law doctrine of negligence were to operate here, whereby general contractor or property owner still could be liable to an injured worker for the negligence of that party, the contractor or the owner, then I think we'd have a better way to encourage workplace safety. Now, I understand earlier today that Mr. Woodbury's attorney had said without the ELA, Mr. Woodbury would have been without a remedy. I think that's not correct. There is still, in Oregon, under the workers' compensation laws, written into the workers' comp law, third-party liability for negligence. If an injured worker can show that the owner or the general contractor actually were negligent, which is not that hard a showing under the Oregon doctrine since the Favolari case came down, then that third party is indeed responsible. It's been said that the new bill, 3605, would impose the $500 non-economic damages cap. That's true only to a certain extent. What it does is make the ELA in line with the general law that in a wrongful death action, there is a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages. Economic damages, of course, are always recoverable in any negligence action, wrongful death or not. But in Mr. Woodbury's case, for example, thank goodness Mr. Woodbury, although grievously injured, is alive. If 3605 passed, he would have a negligence action against the general contractor. And because the Oregon Court of Appeals tells us that the non-economic damages cap is unconstitutional with respect to common law negligence, it's out of your hands. You couldn't put a cap on it. And 3605 does not put a $500,000 cap on non-economic damages for an injured worker. Well, I don't have a lot more to say. I'll certainly be glad to answer any questions you may have. I should point out, additionally, that this bill is not retroactive. It would apply only to causes of action arising in the future. And that the concerns over this act, I think, are either overwrought or plain mistaken. There is, indeed, a cap on non-economic damages for wrongful death, but not for injury. There is extra incentive, I think, from this bill to provide a safe workplace, and I think that the responsibility of contractors and property owners will not go away, certainly could not go away and should not as a matter of policy in this state if 3605 is passed. So I encourage its adoption by the legislature.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. I have with me the written testimony of Dan Harmon, who is from Hoffman Construction and couldn't be here today, but I would like to have that entered into the record as part of the testimony. I just want to offer AOI support for House Bill 3605. We think that it's a balanced solution to a law that has been plaguing some of our members for a fair amount of time. We don't think it's an overly burdensome change, and we urge your adoption.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cindy Coulter and David Anderson. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Durfler and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Cato, and I represent Associated General Contractors. AGC is a commercial construction trade association with about 1,200 members, and those members are involved in every aspect of commercial construction throughout the state of Oregon. There are small, medium, and large contractors and the suppliers of goods and services to those contractors. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak on behalf of AGC in support of House Bill 3605. In addition to my comments, I'd like the record to also reflect that I brought down two letters from AGC members who were unable to come today, McCormick Pacific and Hamilton Construction, and we've handed out those letters so that they can go into the record, and they are also in favor of this bill. I'd like to take just a few moments to make some general comments about the intent of House Bill 3605, and then I'd like to turn the microphone over to a real-life contractor who can talk to you about what his experiences have been with the ELA. First, I want to assure the members of the committee that AGC is not questioning the right of injured workers to be fairly compensated when they're involved in a workplace accident. Everyone on a construction project suffers whenever an employee is injured, or even worse, when they're killed. Our goal with House Bill 3605 is not to avoid responsibility, and it's not to avoid liability where it exists and where a general contractor is truly responsible for the injuries or death of a worker. All we're asking is parity with this bill. We would like to be held to the same standards as other entities are held under tort liability actions in the state of Oregon. As you've heard, the ELA predates the workers' compensation statutes here in Oregon. And we believe that the ELA was not modified previously when the workers' comp law was reformed and when the tort liability actions were reformed, because back then, the ELA really wasn't used that much as a backdoor around exclusive remedy. What we're finding, however, now is that it has become a backdoor around the exclusive remedy provisions of workers' comp law. And these lawsuits have increased both in size and number over the last 5 to 7 years. The ELA lawsuits have also created an uneven playing field for injured workers. All workers who are injured on a construction project are eligible to pursue their recovery through the workers' compensation system. However, through a quirk of fate, if an injured worker is employed by a subcontractor, he or she can also pursue recovery through a lawsuit filed under ELA. General contractors and owners are subject to these third-party legal actions, whereas the direct employer, in most cases, exercises the most control over that employee, is held responsible for workers' compensation only under exclusive remedy. In conclusion, AGC believes that House Bill 3605 offers reasonable solutions to a growing problem. It does not take away the right of the injured worker or his or her survivors to sue a general contractor or an owner for negligence, but it does align the standard of care to that of all other tort actions in the state of Oregon. It puts in place a $500,000 non-economic cap for damages for wrongful death claims only, and that is also consistent with other Oregon statutes. There's no limit on economic damage recovery or non-economic damages for just injured workers. We would ask that you vote yes on this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Gerpler and committee members. My name is Dave Anderson. I'm president of Anderson Construction Company. We are a commercial industrial contractor in Oregon, and I'm here to support 3605. And one thing I've noted as we've been involved in this task, I guess, of getting the Employer Liability Act removed from the law, is I've noticed how it's changed over the years since its first inception in 1911. And one thing that's been most noticeable in the change to me has been the definition of employer. It seems when it first was started that employer meant that you had an employee, and that was somebody in your direct control, me working for you. You are my employer, I'm your employee. Or over the years, workers' comp came into play, and workers' comp essentially took care of the employer-employee relationship. So the law got changed with the definition of employer got altered, and maybe it got altered in case law. I'm not quite sure how it all came about, but it got altered to the point where now employer means anybody but your direct employer. So that's the rest of us out there. And in construction, what we end up having often is a general contractor involved, and that's what I do. I'm the general contractor on a construction project. I go out and bid it directly to the owner, and I hire subcontractors that work with me in pursuit of the completion of the work. So what's happened now is, under the new definition of employer, I seem to be everybody's employer. And so I end up being the guy who's liable now. The Employer Liability Act has that funny word in the middle there, liability, which now, because the law stays in the books, I become the liable party because I'm the employer. And over the years, I've had a number of employer liability claims levied against me. Just some quick war stories. One was a subcontractor, a painting subcontractor. Their employee was a woman who had just got out of a safety meeting regarding proper erection and usage of scaffold, erected her own scaffold, one single frame high, climbed up on it, fell off within minutes, and pursued the workers' comp, and then later pursued a claim against the owner that I was working for, myself, and everybody else on the project, basically was named in it. We spent a considerable amount of money, about $30,000, to prove the fact that we weren't responsible. And we had another one just a few years ago with a steel erection subcontractor. The subcontractor's employee, again, had been noticed not using proper fall restraint by our person, our safety officer in the field, demanded that the individual come down, in fact, demanded that the whole job for that subcontractor be cleared back into the trailers, where they spent the rest of the afternoon in a training session. The next morning, they were involved in a training session before they were allowed to get back up on the structure. And within minutes after they had reached work level, the employee had fallen to the ground and was dead. And again, everybody was named in a lawsuit by the trust, the estate of the killed worker. And it cost a fair amount of money on everybody's part to prove that, in fact, nobody was responsible on our side. What has happened here is that it seems like the standard MO nowadays is throw the liability against the wall and see who it sticks to. And so we spend an awful lot of money protecting ourselves. Now, Anderson's passionate about safety. You heard the fellow of the injured worker from CHM's case here say that contractors and basically owners should have shared responsibility in safety, and I agree wholeheartedly. But I find myself in a catch-22 somewhat, because in some regards, whenever I get involved in a subcontractor safety program, I have now violated the barrier between the contractor, that subcontractor, and myself. I have now somehow gotten myself involved in what would be called exercising control. So here I am. I'm a general contractor that spends an awful lot of money on safety every year. I've got 3 full-time safety people out in the field. I spent a lot of money on consultants, a lot of people involved in training our people. And now I hire a subcontractor who is maybe a one-man show or a two-man show. It's the father and the sons and things like that. They don't have full-time safety people. They aren't up on the latest codes and issues and training methods and equipment. So some would have me believe that I shouldn't get involved at all. But I've walked in violation of that year after year after year. In fact, I'm very involved, and I still get involved. Now I find myself that I could be exposing myself to severe legal implications because I am involved. I think the argument that you heard the attorney make could be played either way. If I get too involved, then I've exercised some sort of joint supervision and control, and I am responsible. If I don't get involved, I should have been involved, and I am responsible. So either way we play this, I am responsible. I think what Cindy mentioned here is what, and you've heard prior, is what we're trying to get to is this parity in the way the law comes down. There's tort law on the books that allows people to pursue claims. If ELA was gone tomorrow, there would be no less an opportunity for any injured worker or their trust or estate to pursue a claim against what they consider to be guilty parties in the death or the injury of their worker. It would not change at all. The one thing that might change is that fewer people pursue claims. And the reason I think that is because now you've got a burden of proof that's shifted slightly. As I am the employer, currently, I'm guilty because I'm the employer. So they just say you're guilty because you were out there by certification, just being there, I'm a guilty guy. Well, now they would have to prove that I'm a guilty guy. So I have in the past thrown out probably nearly $70,000 in defense on just 2 claims, trying to protect myself that I wasn't involved. In fact, on either of those claims, OSHA did not cite us and found us not guilty. In fact, found the worker that had done his own damage and has caused his own harm.
Well, what happens now is we have contracts enforced out on the construction site that basically reflect the mirror back at the employer of this injured worker. So the injured worker is himself or his estate or his trust or people working on his behalf shoot the arrow at everybody out there, and we all turn our contractual mirrors at this arrow as it comes towards us, and it reflects back at his employer. The very employer the workers count was trying to protect ends up getting hurt again. Now, what typically happens, though, is we spend good money trying to defend ourselves, money that does not go into the plaintiff's pocket, typically, or not much of it, because attorneys typically are on contingency, at least the ones I've been involved in, and there's a fair amount of that that goes into their pockets. We tend to throw money just to settle, because let's say it costs us $25,000 to go through a complete lawsuit defense, where they'll say, how about for $15,000, we'll call it a day. And we end up doing that. We give them money just because it's cheaper to settle than it is to fight it all the way. And so this is the kind of thing that's happening out there. Essentially, people say to me, and I just talked to somebody today in the governor's office about this, and they said, well, what's your big issue here? If you've never been found guilty, why do you worry? And I worry because I'm spending my money to defend the fact that I'm not guilty. And he says, well, is that a big issue? I mean, just go out to the sub and get the money back. Go to the guilty party and tell them to pay you. Well, what we have here now is litigation begetting litigation. And I'm not a litigious person, and I'm not a litigious company. And even though maybe litigation is a thing of, you know, more and more we're seeing here in the country and in the world, I don't want to get involved myself. I hate to spend that kind of time doing those kind of things. Removing 3605, once again, will not affect people's rights or ability to bring forth a suit to reclaim things. It'll just make it so that they better have a good story when they come forward. It'll make it more difficult for them to just throw something against the wall and get everybody to start reaching in their pockets and pulling out something less than it costs the full defense. So I'd ask you to support 3605. It's a good thing at this point in time. It'll change back or get rid of this new definition of employer that I labor under now. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Let's see, we've got David Scherer.
Yeah.
We've got Dan, was it? Zwimbaugh.
Robert.
And Bob Shipper. Maybe you could, you have more than just the two of you.
Did you call Dave Scherer first?
Yes.
Okay, I'm by myself. So.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Scherer. I'm a senior vice president with Sedgwick. We are the largest insurance brokerage firm in the state of Oregon. And in that role as insurance brokers, we represent literally hundreds of contractors of all sizes throughout the state handling their insurance needs. On behalf of those contractors that we represent, and these are both large and small, from the Hoffman Construction down to the small specialty contractors, we are urging you to vote in favor of passage of House Bill 3605. We believe passage of this bill will reduce insurance costs for all parties and reduce the ever-increasing litigation we're seeing brought about by these ELA claims. In today's marketplace and from the standpoint of insurance, the number of carriers willing to write general liability coverage for general contractors is shrinking. 10 years ago, we had as many as 15 major carriers that would write liability coverage for general contractors. Today, that number is 4 or 5 and may be reduced to 3 in the very near future. The primary reason for the dramatic reduction in the number of carriers writing this business is due to the ever-increasing litigation and adverse experience from these ELA claims and cases. When a serious on-the-job injury occurs to the employee of a subcontractor, the general contractor is nearly always named in any third-party action. And you just heard that from Mr. Anderson. And this is regardless of fault. The increased frequency of these actions, coupled with the uncertainty of awards, has created a volatile underwriting situation. With increasing uncertainty, fewer underwriters are willing to write liability coverage for general contractors, and frankly, in terms of supply and demand, premiums ultimately increase. Subcontractors are also impacted by the profusion of ELA actions. Because most general contractors require that they be named as additional insureds by their subcontractors, many subcontractors will literally pay twice for the same claim. If an employee of a subcontractor is injured and files a third-party claim against the general contractor, the subcontractor's liability carrier ends up paying the loss if they name the general contractor as an additional insured under their liability policy. And in today's marketplace, that is almost universally the case. If you want to get the job as a subcontractor, you have to name the general contractor as an additional insured. It's just the way it is in the marketplace. So the subcontractor may not be at fault whatsoever. They end up paying both the comp claim and the liability claim. As insurance brokers, we are frequently asked by our clients, well, if that's the case, then how high should my liability limits be? When we are dealing with both general contractors and subcontractors, that's a very difficult question to answer. Does the subcontractor doing the site prep work for the new high school in Beaverton, does he need $1 million in coverage, $10 million in coverage, $25 million, or $50 million? We don't know. The higher limits come at a higher cost, and that's a higher cost we all pay as either consumers or taxpayers. Final comment, the purpose of our workers' comp law was to provide the sole remedy for on-the-job injuries. Through ELA cases, that exclusive protection to employers is being pierced with frequent regularity. Passage of 3605 is a step in the right direction of limiting the amount of awards in ELA cases. I urge this committee to vote in favor of its passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to announce we have some people from Fort on another bill, 2007, so we're going to go until 4:45, and then we'll have to take a break and have some of those people, because they have to leave by 5. So we're going to go ahead and hear 3605 until 4:15, and then we'll take a break for this. So we have Dan? Okay. Would you want to come up and Roger Newber there? Thank you for coming to us.
Thank you for having us, Senator. Senator Durfler, members of this honorable committee. My name is Daniel DeZuba. I'm 50 years old, and until House Bill 3605 was introduced, I have never testified before a legislative committee. But the continued vitality of the employer liability law is of great importance to working men and women, to their families, and to all the people of the state, and that's why I'm here. I represent injured workers every day. You set policy for the state of Oregon. I see the suffering, I see the hopelessness, and I see the fear of people that have suffered catastrophic injuries. And that's what this is about. The employer liability law was enacted in 1910 by initiative of the people. And the basic premise underlying the employer liability law was that safeguards for workers should be as much a cost of doing business as protections for plants or equipment. The workers' compensation law was, and that first workers' compensation law was enacted in Oregon in 1913. And for as long as I've been in practice, which is 25 years, the right to bring a third-party action, including actions under the employer liability law, has been in effect and has been used. The Oregon workers' compensation law was passed in 1913, was amended in 1935, was amended again in 1965, was amended again in 1987, was amended again in 1990, and again in 1995, and no one ever thought of the need for this particular bill as we see it at this particular time. The reason is this. The employer liability law applies to a very small percentage of cases. less than 1% of all on-the-job injuries qualify for the coverage of the employer liability law, and applies specifically to dangerous work. All cases to be eligible for the employer liability law must be inherently dangerous. That's the first thing that you need for liability, for eligibility to bring a case under the employer liability law. And the employer liability law then applies only to two types of cases, and it requires that the person or the entity against whom you bring the case either actually controlled the work or retained the right to control the work on one hand, and on the other hand, the defendant, the employer, and the plaintiff's employer formed integral units on a particular project, and the risk of the defendant's equipment or its activities gave rise to the injury. Let me give you an example. We heard from Mr. Anderson. Actually, I thought that Mr. Anderson's testimony was as telling as any testimony that we have heard. In our system of justice, we can't close the courts. History teaches us the hazard and the danger to a free society from closing the courts. So I suppose anyone can bring an action, but juries are what sort them out. And Mr. Anderson told us that his involvement in construction safety led to him being exonerated in two cases. What we have heard here today was that the employer liability law actually discourages safety because it discourages general contractors from becoming involved. But Mr. Anderson's experience belies that particular concept. Typically what happens on a construction site is this. You have an owner who hires a general contractor who hires subcontractors. And in the contract between the owner and the general contractor is a requirement that the general contractor control the work and be responsible for safety. And there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is the owner doesn't know anything about construction, and so the owner wants somebody that knows about construction and about construction safety to be involved. And so that's what the owner does, is it hires somebody. And the general contractor typically says that it will be in charge of the work. So to say that the employer liability law discourages safety really turns a blind eye to what really happens in the workplace. General contractors are required to be involved with safety. And secondly, any general contractor that sees a dangerous condition, a life-threatening condition, or a condition that can cause serious injury and does nothing about it because the general contractor is afraid of coming under the employer liability law, should not be a general contractor on any project in the state of Oregon, because that general contractor would be shirking its responsibilities. What happens is a well-run construction project, such as Mr. Anderson was talking about, where the general contractor is involved in safety, is one that protects the general contractor and everyone on the construction project. The workings of the inner workings of the workers' compensation law and the employer liability law are this. Somebody is hurt on the job, they receive workers' compensation benefits. And workers' compensation benefits are medical care, they're time loss, which is a portion of your wages, about two-thirds of your wages, up to a certain cap until your condition stabilizes. And if you have a permanent disability, you have a small permanent disability award. And I mean a small permanent disability award. Let me give you an example. It's not unusual for a person who is working construction to make $30,000 a year on a construction job. Let's take a person, a man or woman, that's 30 years old, they're making $30,000 a year. Let's assume that they would work until they're about 60, which is until their work life expectancy. And so over the course of their work life expectancy, without raises or anything like that, that person would make $900,000. Now let's assume that a person suffers a back injury on the job, and because of that back injury, cannot return to employment in their particular activity, but can only return to employment that pays $15,000 a year, and that happens all the time. People that work construction oftentimes don't have the aptitudes to go on to higher education. They make their living with their bodies instead of with their minds. And so a person that suffered an injury like that and can only make $15,000 a year over their 30-year work life expectancy would bring in only $450,000. It's not rocket science to see that that person has lost $450,000 over their work life expectancy. But what amount of workers' compensation permanent disability award will they receive? They will receive a workers' compensation permanent disability award of just over $32,000. And that is it, to compensate them over their entire lifetime for this injury they've had. One of the types of permanent disability or benefits for permanent and total disability. I have a client right now that fell through a skylight on a construction project. She wasn't the first to fall through the skylight. She threw an employee of the general contractor fell through an unguarded skylight 2 months before. And what the general contractor did was covered half of the skylights, but not all of the skylights. And it would have cost another $54 or $72 to cover all of the skylights. But they did not do it to save the money. She fell through and she suffered a brain injury. She's blind in her left eye. She's lost half the field of vision in her right eye. She's lost her entire sense of smell and taste. She broke both of her wrists. She broke her left knee. And she's receiving benefits for permanent and total disability, which are $1,400 a month. By the way, the reason she took a roofing job is she's a single mother and she has five children. And so she receives benefits for permanent and total disability. She received them this year. Last year in the state of Oregon, there were 15 awards of benefits for permanent and total disability. 10 years ago, there were over 100. The courts and the legislature have tightened down on the requirements for receiving benefits for permanent and total disability so that if a person can work part-time at a minimum wage job, are not entitled to benefits for permanent and total disability. I'm not ending my remarks, but I see that my time is running out, and I would ask the chairman what his pleasure is in terms of how to proceed.
Well, we are going to have to take a break because I guess we underestimated some of the time it was going to take up some of these bills, and that's probably my fault. But we do have people that have driven a long ways to testify on another bill, so we're going to take a break and hear them, and then we'll come back now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Robert Newberger. If I could just indulge, I can wait, but we have, and if you could just hear me out, I'm with Mr. DeZuba. These folks have been waiting, and I know you've been very busy. I know you're doing everything you can. Could you just give Mr. DeZuba two more minutes before you take your break so that these folks can go home where they have small children? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I have, I brought together here some of the people that have lost loved ones on construction site accidents who have been protected by the employer liability law. I'd like to introduce them. First of all, I'd like to introduce Jean Dunn and her daughter Jolene, and I'd ask them to stand. In June of 1994, Mrs. Dunn's husband, Donald, was working on a construction project. General contractor out of Kentucky, was out of Kentucky. And he was required to climb a fiberglass tank that was 20 feet high without any safety for doing so being provided. And he fell and landed on his head and suffered injuries that led to his death. The case was settled, but we're not allowed to tell you under the terms of the settlement because there was a gag order imposed by the general contractor, so no one can know the truth of the case. The second person I'd like to introduce is Millie Erickson and her daughter Emily, and I'd like them to stand up. And there's particular relevance here because Mrs. Erickson's husband is the person that was referred to in the June 14, 1999 letter from the Hamilton Construction Company. I promised Mrs. Erickson that I would not talk about the facts of her husband's death because her daughter is here, but I can tell you that the reason he died was because an absolute disregard for safety by the general contractor on the job, and a jury in Oregon so found. And the third person that I would like to introduce to you is Mary Howland. Would you please stand up, Mary? Mary's husband, Larry Howland, was an ODOT inspector, and he was run over by a dump truck, backed over by a dump truck on another Hamilton construction project. The dump truck did not have a backup alarm. The driver tested positive for the use of marijuana, and the windows were broken so the driver couldn't see out the windows. Now, these are the people that are the face of the employer liability law and who the employer liability law protects. The employer liability law in this state, since 1910, has protected people like these widows. And I thank them for being here, and I thank you for indulging me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 3605 for a little bit of time here, and open the public hearing on 2007. And do you have some people, Jeff, from out of town that you'd want to have come up? Thank you for coming. Sorry to make you wait so long.
No problem. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is David Mitchell. I'm the Vice President for Development at the Oregon Health Sciences University, and I also serve as President of the Oregon Health Sciences Foundation, which is the private funding arm for OHSU and for other biomedical research conducted at leading research centers throughout Oregon. I want to speak very, very briefly and hopefully succinctly on behalf of the House Bill 2007, and especially on the language which pertains to Oregon Health Sciences University and our research initiative. I think it's exceedingly well crafted. In fact, it corresponds with similar initiatives in other states, most notably the state of Texas, where some 20 years ago, in a private-public partnership, the University of Texas System, Texas A&M, and other Texas public universities were able to combine tax-generated support as well as private philanthropy to go out and recruit some outstanding scientific talent to the state of Texas, and I think the track record of the University of Texas, Texas A&M, and others stands on its own, particularly in the area of biomedical research. We at OHSU face a very real challenge, and the very real challenge is that while most biomedical research in America is federally funded, it is funded in response to applications from individual faculty investigators, not because a particular university happens to be a good place to work. To that end, every faculty person that is on our faculty or is to be recruited at OHSU stands on his or her own in terms of applying for federal support. However, for us to be successful as a research organization that presumably provides benefits to the state of Oregon and the citizenry, the faculty need first to come to OHSU. They need to be recruited. It was Dr. Charles Dotter who was recruited from the Ivy League in early 1960s and was responsible for a technology which is now called angioplasty. Those of you who know friends or others who have had stents or other rotarooters to unclog black vessels can thank the research that went on at OHSU. I think of the work that goes on in our sports medicine and health promotion program, which perhaps not ironically corresponds with the source of the funds that would come about as a result of the tobacco settlement. The fact is we are one of the leading research centers in America which studies behavior among teenagers as pertains to eating disorders, tobacco use, anabolic steroids, and other types of things in Oregon high schools. These were faculty members recruited from elsewhere with available funds. I am currently chairing the search committee for the new director position of the Center for Women's Health at OHSU. We are literally 90% of the way toward bringing one of the top women researchers from Stanford University to head up the center. It is going to come down to money. Money not for her own compensation, but money to put up the commitment required to bring in an entire research team from Stanford, from other organizations to Oregon to do the research, to do the education of the populace on gender-specific issues pertaining to women. The kind of proposal that is before you is a way to leverage limited public dollars to the greater use, to the greater utility of the state by bringing great researchers to this place, which in turn bring federal research dollars and other biotech dollars to Oregon. We see ourselves as an economic engine as well as an entity that is producing wonderful benefits for the state, and therefore we would like to speak very, very strongly on behalf of this bill. If implemented and adopted, you can be guaranteed that some extraordinary talent is going to be recruited to the state of Oregon, to OHSU, in fulfillment of the research objectives of our organization. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. Jeff, do you have anyone else in our town? Okay. Is there any questions about
the $10 million in the bill takes care of your recruiting of a woman from Stanford?
Well, that would far more than take care of that. In fact, we would only use one of the $10 million, partnering with $2 million in private contributions to establish a permanent faculty position for the director of the Institute of the Women's Center. There would be 9 others that would be created for everything from gene therapy and vaccine development to our heart research program, cancer research, the full range of bench research activities that occur at OHSU, where a permanent endowment is necessary to secure a commitment from one of these leading investigators.
$1 million endowment for each of 10 different.
One from the state, 2 from private contributions from foundations and individuals, for a total of $3 million. So in effect, the $10 million creates $30 million in new money to allow us to recruit.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming down. Okay, we're gonna close the public hearing on 2007. Go back to 3605, and Steve, Bob Newberry, you didn't have a Newberry, I guess you didn't have a chance to testify, and if Bob Shiprack or Jeff Carlson want to come up, that would be fine too.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Neuberger. I practice law in Portland, Oregon, the law firm of Posey Wilson Atchison. Mr. Chairman, again, I want to thank you for the courtesy you showed, and I do mean that very sincerely. I just want to add a few comments to what's already been said and try and take a few of these concepts that are floating around that I think in some way are somewhat maybe contradictory. I want to talk just about a few facts. There's some statements made, well, there's been a big increase in the number of employer liability law cases. The facts are just the opposite. In fact, all personal injury cases, in fact, all property damage cases and personal injury cases have decreased year by year in the state of Oregon for the last 10 years, in fact, in nationwide. And that's true also, I believe, of industrial accidents. As Mr. DeZuba said, employer liability law cases are a very, very small percentage. There has been no expansion of the law. Chairman, as members of the committee, as you know, there are times when you're asked to overrule recent decisions that seem anomalous or that there's a disagreement about public policy. No cases have been cited, and there have been eloquent testimony by the proponents of the bill. Now, there was also a statement that this is going to cost contractors money. We don't have House Bill 3605. And Mr. Anderson pointed out that it's not the general contractor who pays at all. It's the subcontractor. It's the employer. They're the ones that provide the liability insurance by terms of contract. We also heard that there is liability without fault in the employer liability law. The law has been on the books since 1910. Most of the case law, that important case law was decided
much of it before I was born and much of it before I was ever out of high school. So there's been no change in that regard. There's been this liability without fault? No. Or that somehow perverted the definition of employer? No, it is called the employer's liability law. The liability of a general contractor, though, is because it is a general contractor is a person or entity that has charge or control of the work. And that's just not something that some was thought up at the ballot box. That's in every construction contract that's ever been signed. It's also part of the OSHA regulations, both state and federal. In fact, I was in a deposition this morning with one of Oregon's finest general contractors, and I asked him if he recognized these obligations, these responsibilities, and he said, of course. And I said, why? He said, because as a general contractor, I'm the captain of the ship. I mean, after all, if you're an owner and you want something built, you hire an expert. And if you want a building built or a road, and you're going to use subcontractors, someone has to be able to go to the subcontractors and say the quality of the work isn't up to snuff. And that's provided for in the contract. And it's that very same thing that also provides that somebody has to provide for the safety of the public and the workers. Now, we heard about parity. That's an interesting concept. There's a chart attached to Mr. Zuba's testimony. Oregon is the only state on the Pacific coast that doesn't have pure form comparative fault for all torts. Oregon is for almost the whole century has had pure form comparative fault in the Employer Liability Act and since 1971, the 50% rule for general torts. We're not asking today that you go make pure form comparative fault apply in automobile accidents. But that is the law in California, it's the law in Washington, it's the law in Alaska. So if we're going to have parity, let's make Oregon, if we really want to have a parity bill, let's make Oregon like the other states. The other states don't have constitutional caps on damages either. So Oregon would be a sore thumb when it comes to the comparison of the other law. In fact, the bill goes the wrong way. Now, the last thing I want to touch upon is this notion, and with all due respect to the person who said it, I simply suggest that it is at best counterintuitive to say that a law that fosters responsibility is somehow makes the people less safe. And that was a comment that was made about the employer liability law. Now, Mr. Westwood's firm represents Bott Construction, and they were the general contractor out at the Port of Portland. Bott does a lot of work in Seattle, up in Washington. This law isn't going to affect their liability for construction accidents up there. Hoffman Construction does a lot of work, thank you, does a lot of work out of state, California, Washington, Alaska. This isn't going to help them on those accidents. It's only going to mean the Oregonian taxpayers who've been injured or the widows and children of workers who've been killed are going to get less damages. That's the only one. So what's interesting, what happened both in the situation of Millie Erickson, Mrs. Erickson, and Mrs. Howland's husband, was the same thing about Bott Construction. It was eerie. Neither one of those companies claimed to have known what the employer liability law was by name or what their responsibilities were in terms of being responsible for safety. Now, the law simply says, if we're going to walk out of here at the end of the hearing and we're going to walk across the street and you see a child start to run out legally, we have no obligation to stop the child from running out into the street. Now, morally, I would feel an obligation. I think we all would. But no legal liability. Can't be called answerable to damages. The employer liability law says that since the general contractor is the captain of the ship, that the buck stops there, and that the general contractor shall remain responsible. And finally, I want to mention one last word about caps. Mrs. Erickson, Mr. Erickson, survived by his widow, Millie, and their daughter. Under this bill, they would each get $250,000 apiece in non-economic damages. Mr. Howland was survived by his widow, who you met, Mary Howland. They have four children.
5 survivors. They would only get 100,000. Mr. DeZuba comes from a good Catholic family. He was one of 9 children. If his father had been killed, I'll let you do the math. If it had been 10, it would be $50,000 apiece. This bill is anti-family. I happen to believe in personal responsibility. I happen to believe in a free market society. I don't think artificial caps on wages or prices or profits work. And I don't think it makes any difference to have caps. And every credible academic study, every credible insurance study shows that caps on damages do not reduce insurance premiums. They've had a $250,000 cap in medical malpractice cases in California since the mid-1970s, and their insurance premiums aren't any less for their doctors and hospitals than are anywhere else. Thank you very much.
Questions? Let's see. We had Carl Shiprock and Carlson, but you weren't here. You left us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Boss Shiprock. I represent the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council, Union Construction Workers throughout the state of Oregon. To my left is Mr. Jeff Carlson. He's a business agent, field agent for Iron Workers Local 29. I'll try and be brief in my comments. But I'm a little distressed this afternoon, as I was on the House side with this bill, for three reasons, basically. One, that I've got employers here of mine who have a problem that I'd like to help them with. Unfortunately, I don't think this bill solves their problem, and I'll talk about that. Secondly, I'm distressed because in the last 2 years, we've had a lot of construction in this state, a lot of out-of-state contractors, and a lot of dead construction workers. We had an awful season, and very distressed about that as well. And the last thing I'm a little distressed about is I'm wondering if anybody in the room's read the employer liability law. I made a copy that I should have distributed to the committee, but it starts here, this one paragraph. It goes over to here. It's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 paragraphs long. It's a very short law. And what the Employer Liability Act says is that it kind of debunks some of the things that my general contractors have stated as a problem, in that when they engage in job safety in the workplace, which is their responsibility, they feel that they're being tagged. I just want to read what the law says is that all owners, contractors, or subcontractors and other persons having charge of or responsibility for any work involving a risk or danger to the employees or the public shall use every device, care, and precaution that is practicable to use for the protection and safety of life and limb, limited only by the necessity for preserving the efficiency of the structure, machine, or other apparatus or device, and without regard to the additional cost of suitable material or safety appliance and devices. The law goes on to, name that on a construction site, the contractor is responsible for job site general conditions. It doesn't say that in that language, but I can read it if you want. It says the owners, contractors, subcontractors, foremen, architects, or other persons having charge of the particular work shall see that the requirements of ORS 654-305-335 are complied with, and that is the Employer Liability Act. Also goes on to state that the manager, superintendent, foreman, or other person in charge or control of all or part of the construction, works, or operation shall be held to be the agent of the employer in all suits for damages for death or injury suffered by an employee. That's what the law says, and I think that, unfortunately, some of my contractors have been led to believe that what they're doing right has got them in trouble, when in fact the law is perfectly clear that it is their responsibility. Some of the other problems that have been mentioned is that contractors don't want to be sued, and I can certainly relate to that. Nobody wants to be sued. I don't see anything in this bill, however, that would stop people from filing lawsuits. There is a burden. There was a talk, at least the representative from AOI would have been more clear. What is the burden to owners? I was told on the House side there's been a Supreme Court case, I believe it was PGE versus somebody, that clearly the court says the owner hires people of expertise to build things and is not liable in those instances. The other thing was brought up is defense costs are high, and indeed they are. I don't see anything in House Bill 3506 which puts a limit on defense costs. They're still going to have defense costs. There's also been talk about this as a backdoor to exclusive remedy. I've got, I requested on the House side, the committee administrator, Mr. Aaron Felton, to get some statistics. One of the things we had on the House side was absolutely no statistics on what the real problem is. This is from Mr. Davey of Safe Corporation. About SAFE receives about 35,000 claims a year. About 250 of those claims are pursued under the Employer Liability Act. Of those death claims, they have about 5 to 10 per year involving loss of life. So that's what we're talking about here as far as the extent of the problem, at least under the best statistics we can get. In construction, Mr. Chairman, you can have a great general contractor who enforces safety and health on the job site, but because we're a multi-employer situation, we'll have 16, 20 different subcontractors, and they might not be so good. Contracts only need one or two that can actually spoil a job, and therefore, one of the reasons the exclusive remedy doesn't work is you can have a good subcontractor, general contractor who treats their people well. However, the person working right next to him may have an employer who has ignored or doesn't follow the safety of the job site and can hurt people. And therefore, the good employer is therefore damaged, and this provides a remedy for them to recover their workers' comp costs, which was explained earlier, and I'll dwell on that. Generally speaking, it's always been my experience, a general contractor, now this new creature, lately a construction manager, who may not have any direct hire employees on the job, are in control of job site safety. In fact, it's right in their contract that they are, that they do enforce that and negotiate contracts, and that's clearly, one of the first things that's always discussed is how the general will control job site safety. Next thing I wonder is how many successful suits. We've heard a lot, both here and in the House, about the lawsuits, but it was kind of glossed over as to how many are really successful. It's what I'm hearing is that there weren't that many successful suits under this act. Again, that might be something the committee could delve into. It's just a suggestion. The bottom line is I'm not sure what I can point to in this bill that really helps these general contractors. It also goes against the intent of our workers' comp reforms, where I'm sure you recall, Mr. Chairman, Oregon was one of the first states to put a heavy emphasis on job site safety in order to prevent accidents, illnesses, and lower the costs of construction and workers' compensation insurance. The other thing we did in our workers' compensation reforms that kind of sticks out in this bill is we made a deliberate attempt not to cut people's benefits, but instead to look at the underlying root causes of the escalation in costs. It's so simple to go in and simply slash benefits and say you've done something when you really haven't attacked or solved any of the problems underlying the main problem you're trying to get to. That's about all I had to say, and I just urge the committee to examine this so very closely. What is it really going to do? I would ask the people that have brought the bill forward to also take a second look at this and ask themselves, what good is this bill really going to do me other than just going to hurt a few people that have already been hurt bad enough?
Bob, would you consider the, I guess the case is who is the employer and who is the who is not the employer? Would you consider the general contractor to be the employer?
No. No, he is not. He's the employer of his own people. He is simply in charge of the general conditions on the job site. Somebody's got to be the boss, and the general contractors, they're in charge of scheduling, making sure the materials are there, the subs are there, the plans, the drawings, and all that. And one of their other functions is job site safety, general conditions. We lost an apprentice sheet metal worker down in Eugene 2 years ago. I mean, stupid. He walked through a hole in the floor that wasn't guarded. He killed himself. He was probably packing some duct. Didn't look where he was walking. There's this big hole in the floor, and he fell through it. That's the general contractor's clear responsibility to see that those holes are covered.
The North Shut Comp system is a no-fault system.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're finding fault with someone else who is not the employer, which doesn't seem to, at least my stream of logic, which doesn't say that's the right way to go. If we're going to do that, why shouldn't the general contractor then be able to provide workers' comp, which becomes exclusive only for that individual?
I think it's direction and control goes back to these are old common law statutes, master-servant relationship, all that wonderful stuff.
But you'd have to admit that some of these accidents are negligent on the employee's part.
And absolutely.
And you're wanting the employer to pay for it.
And in fact, the other part of this bill that we don't really talk about too much were changes to comparative fault standards. Even under the current pure comparative fault, the worker's negligence counts against the award. That a jury may find. So worker negligence is taken into account even under today's standards.
Should the employer be able to sue the negligent employee at the same time?
Well, that would fly in the face of the Occupational Safety and Health Act that Congress passed, where Congress simply said that safety is responsibility totally of the employer. The remedy the employer has, and we wholeheartedly support this concept, is if you have an unsafe employee, fire him.
Pretty hard to do. Sir.
Terminate him.
Pretty hard to do.
Oh, he'd be surprised. In construction, we call it just getting your money, and it's that quick. Guy comes out and hands you your check.
Yeah. I guess I'm still struggling with that. If it is a no-fault system, now it isn't a no-fault system.
This particular act is not no-fault. It is it's a tort system, like somebody runs into you with their car.
Mm-hmm.
Negligence with the third party, it's out of your control.
Okay. I'm still struggling with it.
Well, it's...
Because there are lots of cases where these people could have avoided the accident themselves, and yet they're holding the employer totally... Not even an employer, some third party person responsible for an action that he could have avoided himself.
And in those cases, they probably lose the suits, even if successful. Again, Mr. Chairman.
You also heard this gentleman in the two cases, $70,000 in attorney fees.
I deeply sympathize with Mr. Anderson on that. I don't know how you reform the court system, however, and that's a fact of life. I think there's some things that we could do. I think you'd be hearing a bill of mine coming up where I'm going to propose dealing with my employers, where you have union contracts that you can put in an alternative dispute resolution. I've proposed to some people that, as far as I'm concerned, and Mr. Carlson and I have discussed this, why don't we at least try mediating some of these disputes?
It wouldn't bother me. You are better than paying the attorney fees, I think.
If it would.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Carlson. I represent Ironworkers Local 29. I'm here to oppose House Bill 3605. This bill is a slap in the face to men and women who are employed in hazardous occupations, such as the ironworkers trade. Contractors equipped to say that safety is the number one priority on the job. In my 26 years as an iron worker, I'm here to tell you the reality of job safety. Huge improvements regarding safety have been made in the construction industry over the past 20 years. However, if concrete is scheduled first thing in the morning or a project is running long on man hours and the job budget is getting tight, contractors are inclined to look the other way and safety takes a back seat to production. I have seen employees lose their jobs for complaining about job safety. Pressure is put on crews to increase production. Employees either pick up the pace or they lose their jobs. House Bill 3605 will erode safety in the construction industry. House Bill 3605 tells surviving widows and children they do not count. It says that we don't care about their well-being, and it says we are not concerned about the future. Remember that the surviving family members have already had their lives shattered. Please take a moment and just imagine if when you kissed your spouse this morning as he or she left for work, that this would be the last time you've seen them alive. Try to feel the emotional devastation the moment you tell your children that mommy or daddy died at work today and will never be coming home again. Picture learning that your spouse's death was preventable. Life is a struggle when things are going well. Try to picture the struggle this bill would impose on the surviving family members. Don't forget the families. Don't protect employers who put profits before safety. And please do not support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you for testimony. Thank you both. Let's see, we got Arthur Kunis and Patrick O'Brien.
Go ahead and test that. I'll be right here. I'm right here.
Hi there. I don't know. She's still in the room. Oh. But why don't you go right ahead anyway?
Okay.
There's no sense of holding this up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Kunis. I'm Research and Education Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 125 union members throughout the state of Oregon. I'm before you today in opposition of this bill. House Bill 3605 represents a calamity for people who work in Oregon. By removing Oregon's employer liability law, you are telling the working people of this state that their lives are of little value or consequence. You are declaring to their families that they have no right of redress, even if the employer who caused the death of their loved one was grossly negligent. And I realize that may be incorrect as far as this bill is concerned. So I disregard the grossly negligent part. That employer reigns supreme. Workers are reduced to subjugation. It appears to us that this bill attempts to limit legal awards to $500,000, the very idea of placing a price cap on the life of a person dying in the line of duty from injury or occupational disease is repugnant to working people. Oregon does not need this shame brought upon it by the passage of House Bill 3605. It is an insult to those who die on the job and to their families. It is a disgrace on our workplace. We feel that it would be a far better thing to strengthen Oregon's Occupational Safety and Health Administration to help reduce the rate of fatalities on the job and from job-related causes than to place a dollar value on the lives of those who toil in this state and to their families. The Oregon AFL-CIO strongly opposes this bill and urges you to defeat it.
Thank you. I guess the only thing I would say to you is you sound as if every employer is a bad person. I don't find that to be true, and I think some of the employees that have these actions have to take some responsibility for their actions also. Every employee, I mean, I've seen employers try really hard to make a safe workplace. And if the employees ignore it, and yet they're still it's still the responsibility of the employer. I don't quite follow your reasoning.
Well, my personal history is I'm a carpenter for, I've been a carpenter for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Both on the union and non-union side, heavy construction, light construction, residential, I've experienced it all.
Mm-hmm.
And as Jeff Carlson just said, in the last 20 years, safety has improved dramatically, geometrically, over what it has been previously. But there are many instances on a job, such as what Mr. Shipwreck mentioned, where a sheet metal worker encountered a hole in the floor, and you know, you could somehow construe that was his fault for not paying attention to where he was. But when you're involved in that activity on a job, you have to pay attention because it's dangerous work. But there are some factors like holes in floors that absolutely, unquestionably, are the responsibility of the general contractor to make sure that those sorts of hazards are covered. I myself, about 5 years ago, was on a scaffold on the OSU campus. And I didn't erect the scaffold. A certified scaffold erector erected that scaffold. And as I was walking along the planks on that scaffold, I encountered a plank that was, one end was not attached to anything. And I almost fell 3 stories to the ground. Now, I don't believe that was caused by my negligence. I don't know whose fault that was, but I do believe, had I been killed, that would have been the responsibility and should have been the responsibility of the person, the outfit that erected that scaffold and the general contractor of that job.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I'll tell you, I was an employer for many years, and I've seen some employees do some crazy things, and
of course.
I tried to correct them. But you, when I listen to your testimony, you're telling me every employee is great, but every employer is bad. I just sort of take it.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Well, that's what I heard you saying in your testimony.
I don't mean to imply that
okay.
at all.
Right. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, we have one last, and that's Patrick O'Brien. And if you could hurry up, because we've got another bill to hear yet tonight, and maybe late tonight if you don't get some of this information done. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Senator Durfler. I'll do the best I can to be brief. Please excuse me. I've had to rewrite my testimony listening to all the prior testimony, and
okay.
So I'll try to muddle through it as rapidly as I can. again, good afternoon or good evening. Chair Durfler and members of the committee, my name is Patrick O'Brien. I'm a native Oregonian. I reside in Westland, Oregon. I'm a 73 graduate of the Oregon State University Construction Engineering Management Program. We are a small commercial, industrial, and public works building contractor in Portland, and we're members of the Oregon Columbia chapter of the AGC. I'm a past president of the AGC and sit on the National AGC Board. I come here in support of HB 3605-A. Okay, that's the end of my testimony as written. I'd like to make a couple points that I think hopefully will bring a little bit of closure to the discussion this afternoon. First of all, I think anybody that's in the construction business, and that includes two of us that have testified this evening, including myself, a well-run, safe job site can have accidents. It's unfortunate, but it happens. Captain of the ship, if a captain of a Navy ship had the lack of rights and the lack of responsibility that the law has forced on the general contractor, we would not have a Navy. Generally, the general contractor in safety issues and third-party action overs is guilty until proven innocent. And I think that's something that Dave Anderson alluded to earlier. As far as job site safety is concerned, yes, overall job site safety is responsible to the general contractor. Ideally, and in a perfect world, so is individual subcontractor safety. The general contractor must rely on the expertise of the subcontractor for the particular safety required for that particular trade. It's very important. We are a jack of all trades, and we readily admit we're a master of none, except for the very items that we have control over, which might be concrete and carpentry framing. As general contractors, we get to try to make the laws that you have made work for us. We have to take the laws and make them work at the job site. Current law puts us in a position of being responsible for all and gives us no control over anyone. And it's very unfortunate and it's very difficult to have control over safety on a job site when, in fact, you do not have that control. Well, I'm not an attorney. I'm a contractor. I build things. I consider myself to be an expert at building things. Unfortunately, I find myself, as a result of what we're dealing with today, spending more and more time with legal issues and less time contracting and less time trying to provide for the safety on our job sites. Oregon is not necessarily a unique state, but there are other states out there that address this issue and I think have done it fairly. Essentially, all complying employers on a job site enjoy the same immunity from prosecution in the case of injury or death. And I think that's a fair way to deal with job site-related injuries and death. It shares the responsibility. It allows the general contractor the opportunity to help the subcontractor provide for a safe job site. And that's what we're looking for here. Unfortunately, the current law, despite what we've heard earlier, positions us as general contractors, and I know this because I'm out there every day, it positions us in such a manner that we have to understand exactly what we can tell our subcontractor. And that is, right now, get off the job. You're being unsafe. We can't help him. We can't instruct him. All we can do is demand that he get off the job. And don't come back until you can get your act together. We can instruct him. And this is incredibly unfortunate. We ought to be working together to provide job site safety for everybody at the site. Third-party action overs, despite what you've heard today, are becoming very predominant in our industry. You heard from our insurance people that we're starting to lose insurance coverage. Okay, if this is not a trend, then why are insurance carriers refusing to write policies for general contractors in the state of Oregon? We are down to 4 carriers in this state that will write general contractors. And part of the problem is third-party action overs. Max Woodbury, who we heard testify earlier, is a case in point. He is the very person that we need to try to protect. If we can have full job site cooperation and safety between the general contractor and all subs and everybody that walks on the job site, whether it's the building inspector, the engineer, the architect, or the owner, we're going to have safe job sites. Currently, we don't have that. We have people positioning themselves to protect a potential for risk, which is incredibly unfortunate. 2 years ago next month, I was sitting in a job trailer, and I heard this terrible knock on a door and an iron worker screaming, "We have a man down, we have a man down." A minute later, I was out into our project, which happened to be a performing arts center in Portland, and there was an iron worker on the concrete. It was my carpenters that responded to the iron worker on the concrete. It was my carpenters that were trying to take care of this man. They were trying to allow him to breathe. They were trying to get the debris and the tools off of him. It was my carpenter, who was a trained EMT, that was trying to give this person initial life safety aid. It was this carpenter that came to me and said, "Pat, I did the best I can. He's barely got a pulse, but I can't give him any CPR because his head and his chest are crushed, and I'm afraid I damaged him further." It was my carpenters that ran out into the street and grabbed the ambulance and cleared a path and organized the job site and organized the subcontractors to allow for this person to be administered as quickly as possible. It was my carpenters that helped get this person out of the site. Unfortunately, he was dead. But had he been injured, we would have had him to the hospital very quickly as a result of all their activities. And this is purely because they're trained to do this. They're trained to react. But they're not only trained to react, they're trained to be proactive and to prevent those very types of accidents from happening. Now, this was an iron worker, and he was working undirected by my company. In fact, we didn't even know he was in the position he was in until after he had fallen. Had it been my carpenter wouldn't have the same rights that the iron worker had. He would not have had the same rights. He could have not have sued on a third-party action order unless he could have proven gross negligence on the part of another subcontractor. Well, the other subs don't have the same rights and responsibilities that the general contractor has. It's very important to keep that in mind here. Well, I guess in closing, I'd like to say that generally, as far as the workers' compensation third-party action over general liability issues are concerned, I agree with Bob Shiprack. It is a mess. We're trying to sort it out. This is the very beginning. It's a small thing. It's a small movement forward. We're hopeful that maybe all of us working together, just like we need to have on the job site with safety, we can make this problem go away, and we can make some sense of this. In closing, I'd like to say that from a business perspective, most of the testimony I've heard has been discussing cases by big general contractors. You know, the $100 million guys, the billion-dollar guys. Well, we're not that. We're a small contractor. We take great pride in our safety program. We work very hard at it. We do everything we can to provide not only our own employees, but also all of the subcontractor employees as safe a job site as we can possibly provide them. But the reality of the current market is this. Limits of coverage that are generally carried by a general contractor of our size, and keep in mind that 95% of the contractors in Oregon are small business contractors, the coverage is $1 to $5 million. On third-party action overs, death claims, current prayers are running $5, $10, $15, $20, and $30 million. I can tell you what happened to our company. 3 months after our accident that I mentioned earlier, we were slapped with a $15 million lawsuit. I have $5 million worth of insurance coverage. At the time, I had 80 employees. As soon as I was served the lawsuit in the office, it couldn't have been an hour later that everybody in my company knew what happened. Many of those employees worked for me for more than 15 years. I had 10 or 15 calls that very day. Pat, am I going to have a job tomorrow? What is this $15 million lawsuit stuff? What's it going to do to you? So if we're saying that modifications in the workers' compensation third-party action order laws that currently govern this state don't have any impact on the small person, I beg to differ. I consider myself to be a small contractor. The people that work for me are laborers and carpenters. They're very loyal and hardworking people, and they deserve their jobs. They don't deserve to be in fear of them. In this particular case, even if they split the original prayer in two to $7.5 million, and we had for some reason lost the case, it would have been $2.5 million out of pocket. My company would be dissolved. I would be out of business. Those people would be unemployed. There's a very, very real human price to pay for these lawsuits in the current order of magnitude, and it's important to understand this. So there is a reason for general contractors to be supporting House Bill 3605A. I'm supporting this House bill, and I urge you to support it also. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Anyone else on this bill? Okay. We will close the public hearing on 3605, excuse me, and we're going to open up a public hearing on 2007. And on 2007, do we have anybody from out of town? Okay, why don't you come on up if you would, please. Sorry to make you wait so long.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, Sherman County Judge, and here today as President of the Association of Oregon Counties, I'd like to speak in support of House Bill 2007. Our association has endorsed the concept of 2007.
Wait a minute before we get some everybody moved out here. Sorry about that. Okay. No,
as I said, our association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Mike MacArthur, Sherman County Judge. I'm here in the capacity of my role as President of the Association of Oregon Counties. We're in support of the concept of House Bill 2007. We're particularly in support of the creation of a health security fund. We're appreciative that leadership has sought to include in this bill the provision that includes local public and mental health services. This is another one of those areas where counties are a partner with the state, much like the district attorney's program, county community corrections, and our court system. In that partnership, ORS 431 requires that public health services be provided by counties, and ORS Chapter 430 provides that mental health services be provided by counties. And these are undertaken to protect the health and safety of communities in general. The problem with our partnership, as you know, Senator Gerfler and others, county resources are not what they've been. Property tax reductions, forced receipts have dropped. I was at your press conference today when the budget was presented, and the talk about 14% increase in state funding, I can assure you that there aren't counties that are increasing budgets at 14%. Our increases are much more modest, if not in the other direction. So any particular help that we can get for these services is very much appreciated, and I think 2007 does that. I also appreciate the flexibility for local government to determine the allocation ratio. The provision in the bill allows that allocation to be made by the local government for health-related applications of the money that's available. Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maggie Moran. I am a local health department administrator. In my particular county, both public health and mental health are providing services from the same department. I'm here before you to represent the perspective of local public health and mental health programs. I'm here today specifically to provide testimony related to House Bill 2007, which calls for the utilization of federal trust fund monies to establish the Oregon Health Security Fund and allocate interest from that trust fund to health-related purposes. We're particularly supportive of the proposed allocation of trust fund interest for local public health and mental health services on an ongoing basis. Local public health and mental health services provided by counties are the backbone of Oregon's prevention, intervention, and treatment delivery system. For example, our state statute, ORS Chapter 431, require local public health departments to provide communicable disease control, immunizations, maternal and child health, environmental health, and other population protection and prevention services. Requirements of our local mental health system, ORS Chapter 430, include mental health crisis and commitment services, and case management of former state hospital clients and individuals with developmental disabilities. Unfortunately, consistent, reliable, and sustained funding for these programs has not been forthcoming, resulting in further erosion of county health and mental health infrastructure, as well as services. The Conference of Local Health Officials and the Association of Community Health Programs would appreciate your consideration of the following aspects of House Bill 2007. This proposal reflects an appropriate use of tobacco settlement dollars, which were intended to compensate states for Medicaid expenses. Demands for increased Medicaid funding over the years have come at the expense of funding essential community health services. $7 million per year is made available to counties to preserve the local infrastructure for public health and mental health services. Counties have been in historic partnership with the state, and while certainly dollars are always limited, it's more important for counties to have some assurance of the state help for the duration. Health services provided by counties are required by law for public health and mental health, and unlike personal health care services, are undertaken in order to protect the health and safety of populations and communities. County health programs have fallen behind in receiving adequate state funding for essential public health and mental health services, such as communicable disease investigations and control, mental health crisis and commitment services. Also, property tax limitations and reduced timber receipts have further restricted counties' ability to fund local health programs. In conclusion, the local health officials and mental health directors support the creation of the proposed health security fund and the allocation for local public and mental health programs. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming to testify. Any questions? Again, thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'm going to see Ed Patterson. I don't see Ed here. See, you don't look like. You don't look like you have. That's fine, too. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
You're better looking in there, too.
Oh, thank you. I'll tell him that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jill Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and Ann Ketterson was unable to be here because he has another meeting going on at the moment. What we are passing out to you today is a letter that was written by the Hospital Association's Executive Committee back in March when House Bill 2007 was introduced, and most of the information in that, our position in that, is pretty clear and still pretty consistent. There's a couple things I do want to just get on the record. One of them is that, as we did in the letter, we commended you for your leadership in establishing a health security trust fund, and we think it's a good sound public policy, and also that it would have good public support. The good policy part comes because we believe that part of the purpose of the tobacco settlement money was to provide health care for the poor across the country. And from the good public support standpoint, we believe that it sort of follows along with the ballot measure 44 in 1996, which established the cigarette tax to fund the Oregon Health Plan, which also is health care funding for the poor. We also think it makes sound fiscal sense because in the event that there is an economic downturn, it does provide some monies in the future to fund health care services. Beyond that, I just wanted to mention that while we support 2007 in its current form, we did originally have a slightly different definition of health care, and we would like to bring that to your attention. Other than that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much for your testimony. Did we have a session?
No.
Dave Mitchell, is he still
here? Oh, wait.
He is here. Okay, Tom Novick and Ann Croft. Maybe you could both come together if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll make this brief since it's getting late. Tom Novick, representing the Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco this evening, which is the Cancer Association, Heart Association, and Lung Association. I checked the box in between support and...
Yeah, I noticed you couldn't make up your mind.
Well, it's... we are not necessarily opposed to the idea of a trust fund, but let me briefly let you know our position. We believe that a significant portion of the settlement provides a real opportunity for the legislature to tackle the problem that the lawsuit was first brought to deal with, and that is the issue of cost to Oregonians of tobacco use in our state, direct and indirect costs, whether it's the cost we pay as taxpayers through the health plan. For example, 41% of the individuals that are on the health plan smoke as opposed to 25% of the general public, and the costs associated with that are significant. We believe that there's an opportunity to use some of these funds to supplement the current cessation and prevention program that we have here in the state, which is very effective. Since it's been implemented from ballot measure 44, we've seen an 11% decrease in smoking in the state, about 500 million less cigarettes sold in the last couple of years. Less people smoking means less cost to us as taxpayers. So we would advocate a larger portion than 10% of the interest from the settlement to go to that. To give you another example, the state of Washington to the north of us, their recently concluded legislature allocated $100 million over the next biennium for smoking cessation and prevention. Under House Bill 2007, as it currently stands, we would put about an additional $700,000, between $700,000 and $1 million in the next biennium. And we just think that given the payback on money with prevention and cessation, roughly $22 for every dollar invested, that it's a smart investment at this time to do. So that is why we checked the box in the middle. I've passed out testimony that we gave before the House Committee, which goes into this in more detail. But in closing, the cost to Oregonians are huge. Adults who smoke in Oregon are about 21%. High school students who smoke are 23%, the equivalent of a classroom of kids start smoking every day in Oregon. At the current rate, 50, 61,000 kids who are alive today will die from smoking-related illnesses. It's an area where we can make a real impact. So we would think that since the taxpayers already foot the bill for about $350 million in direct public expenditures due to smoking, that additional money into prevention and cessation is a good way to go.
Thank you. Dave, thank you for coming in.
Hello, thank you. My name is Ann Crawford, and I'm the program director for a local community-wide coalition, and I'm here to let you know of some of the successes that we've had and to let you know our position. Salem Kaiser Together is a community drug prevention network, and we represent over 50 organizations and individuals and private people from the medical community. And we have been working for many years in Salem Kaiser to eliminate the use and to help prevent alcohol, drug, and substance abuse and tobacco use among young people and families. Because of our expanded tobacco efforts and because of Measure 44 money, we were able to reduce the illegal sales of tobacco products to minors by 30%. In addition, the Salem Kaiser middle and high school students are using tobacco 50% less than the state average. And since 1996, 35,000 fewer Oregonians smoke as a result of statewide prevention efforts. We know that prevention works, and we know that we need to be doing more. 10% of the interest for tobacco prevention is really not acceptable. Tobacco prevention works, and it is the best return of an investment, as Tom indicated, that the legislature could make, saving $22 taxpayer dollars for every $1 spent on prevention. House Bill 2007, as it is currently written, only would allocate $700,000 additional monies per year for the first several years toward tobacco prevention efforts, placing programs like housing and transportation before prevention. The tobacco settlement came from tobacco problems. The first priority should be to adequately fund a strong tobacco prevention program. And we urge you to consider changing House Bill 2007 to allocate more funding to prevention and to do the right thing with the tobacco settlement money.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions, Tom? Thanks for testifying.
Thank you.
Let's see, Jane Myers and Riley Weisbeck. No, this doesn't look like Jane for me. Riley, do you want to come up also?
I'm Dr. Jim Pratsky. I'm a general dentist in Salem and a past president of the Oregon Dental Association, and I'm here to represent the Oregon Dental Association. And to the members of the Public Affairs Committee, we'd like to bring out some points, some problems of dental care among children. The two-thirds of the children with severe cavities who need a referral to a pediatric dentist are waiting 30 to 90 days for care. And most pediatric dentists work 32 to 40 hours a week in direct patient care. Over half are over 50 years old, moving toward retirement age. Nationally, fewer pediatric dentists are being trained. The supply is getting smaller while the need is growing. We need to train pediatric dentists to solve this problem. And we're asking to please support an amendment to HB 2007 to provide $2 million to restart the pediatric dental residency program at OHSU Dental School, and $1 million of this will be as a one-time cost to renovate the clinic. The problem really can't wait for the next session. Many of the children who need treatment are in pain and their teeth are deteriorating. Please give some thought to the attached study and take some action to solve the problem. Thank you for your generous attention.
Jim, what you're asking for is some of the money to go for the pediatric dental care, is that what?
Well, what is to establish a graduate program at the dental school for pediatric program, and it's seemed to be a crisis in dentistry. We're getting more children with the management problems. And myself, as an example, as a general dentist, really are not trained to do the things a pediatric dentist is trained to do, such as general anesthesia in the hospital environment. And it's really getting to a crisis situation, and I really feel there's a terrific need for this program.
Okay. Thank you. Jane, do you want to add to this stuff, please?
No, you're here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers for the Oregon Dental Association, and I thank Dr. Pratsky for covering for me. I was on another bill, but the answer to the question is yes. The interest, if it's being the way Health Bill 2007A is constructed, that's what we would like to conceptually have an amendment to spend the interest. We've realized that the budget process that we've heard about today includes not spending anything but the interest on that fund.
That's where we're starting, right?
Yes.
Okay. Questions? Thanks for staying around so long.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock. I'm Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury, and I've passed out more information than I'm going to go through, and particularly in light of the time. The wide sheet compares the various proposals that are on the table for health care, and I think the plea that I'd like to make today is that the committee considers securitization for part of for this fund. And let me make that very brief. We have no problem at all with development of a health care security fund. It makes an awful lot of sense to tie up the money in that way. It was part of the intent of the tobacco settlement, and there's no problem whatsoever with that. We think we can bring to you a way of implementing that fund in more economical way and getting you more dollars on the table more quickly. And I've made just a couple brief notes I'll run through that captures a lot of what's in that document, you know, that you can use for further reference. What House Bill 2007 would do, which is basically listed under the first column there, it uses the cash flow only to build this fund. That cash flow has some risk for a reduction from the tobacco settlement revenues. Should something happen to those revenues, that cash flow will diminish, less money then will subsequently be delivered to the healthcare area that you're trying to accomplish. It begins with a very small pot. You know, you're beginning with the cash flow, and that cash flow has to build, understanding that cash flow can be interrupted anytime the settlement is interrupted, and there's some possibility of that. It also has risk of raids, and it's built into the bill, I believe, that the legislature can use it as a budget stabilization fund. The legislature, you know, this is statutory. The legislature would have the authority to divert that money sometime in the future. And I don't think it's the intent of 2007, and certainly not in the best interest of creating that kind of health fund, is to make it susceptible to either legislative raids or raids from initiative or anything else that the money should really go for. Health care is being discussed here, and we'd like to be able to protect it. I think we have some suggestions on how. With securitization, what happens is you sell a small portion of the cash flow. It's not debt, and it is handled differently in the marketplace than debt, though the instruments for the sale of that cash flow would be bonds, but it is not debt. There is no further obligation on the part of the state of Oregon. Should cash flows cease at any particular point, there is no further obligation on the part of the state of Oregon to pay back, to repay that line, as there is in debt. Should that cash flow stop in a debt situation, the state would be obligated to continue to make payments. There is no risk to that fund then of diminishing tobacco settlement cash flow. Should something ever happen to the tobacco settlement cash flow, the fund would already be in place, and there is no liability that the fund would have. It would be protected. It builds a large pot fast, and let me just run through some numbers. We're looking at cash flows of about $80 million a year, roughly, that come in from the tobacco settlement. You are constitutionally prohibited from investing that money in equities. There is a constitutional prohibition. We would have to invest that money. We would be the people who would invest the money. We would invest it in bonds, and you're going to get about 5% return. Your $80 million initial cash flow is going to generate, the math is very simple, 4%, $4 million. year one, $8 million, you know, year two, and it builds from that. It will take a number of years to get the kind of return that we think we can generate for you if we were able to securitize that fund. We think we can generate returns, and we have another recommendation, that will help to generate these returns, but it returns in about $36 million a year forever. And that's quite an impact, and it gets you, I think, where you want to be faster and allows more distribution, more use for the health in the healthcare area. How do we get to the $36 million if that level of fund is, we're going to recommend, suggest to you that if this fund were taken to the voters as a constitutional provision, and secured in this way, you could protect the fund from the raids from the legislature, raids from outside sources, in any way. You can protect it very strongly in that area, and understanding another constitutional provision could change it, but that is more difficult to do. It stops easy access to the money. But I would also suggest that if you did that, that we take the time to allow us to invest those monies in equities as we do in the Common School Fund. It's a very conservative investment, but we can generate in excess of 9%, it's a hair over 9% that we generate long-term for those investments. And you really get a lot more bang for your buck in that way. It really allows this fund to deliver what I think what you want to deliver, but it also protects it from being diffused in areas that you don't intend now. As a statutory fund, as you well know, I think a fund that we can look back on is the Educational Endowment Fund. Somebody captured the interest off of that for debt for 15 years. It's captured for 15 years, can't be changed, and we're stuck with it. If we made a provision in the constitutional amendment when we created this fund as a constitutional fund that, in fact, the interest could not be used to securitize long-term debt, that could help to protect it and I think secure what a lot of us would like to see through this fund. I want to throw those ideas out for you. We're here to work with you, in fact, if there's any interest in it, as you know, but I just wanted to make our commitment to this fund and its success, you know, get it on the record. The one other thing I would like to add, and I'm not here to discuss education or get a sense of that discussion, you know, in this committee, but I would like to go down to the bottom of the page of that long sheet that I handed out and talk about a budget stabilization fund. Somehow, with the use of, we have an opportunity to protect health care. We have an opportunity to protect education, and we have an opportunity to protect another core service and safety with the Budget Stabilization Fund. And I think it does address some health care needs. We strongly recommend the state needs a Budget Stabilization Fund. And the only source of revenue that I see that, in fact, can, you know, can address even a part of it is the tobacco settlement money. We think there's a legitimate case for the health of the state, financial health of the state, in creating a budget stabilization fund. It's one of the reasons why our bond rating has not been increased. We have a good bond rating, a double A. We're proud of it. But there is no reason in the world that the state should not have a double A plus. That saves the state hundreds of millions of dollars as we issue debt, and the state will continue to issue debt over the years. And the major obstacle, according to the bond rating agencies themselves, is the fact that we do not have a budget stabilization fund. This would help, you know, a great deal in that area. The fund that we've talked about, the way we would see it organized, basically would protect education at 60% of whatever the budget stabilization fund, healthcare at 20%, and public safety at 20%. Those are the three core budgets in the state, or areas that in the state, and certainly core services, and we at least wanted to get that on the table for discussion. And with that, I understand that the time is, you know, is flying, so I'm going to terminate my testimony. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your courtesy, sir.
I don't see this with you, but I appreciate you answering again.
Thank you, sir.
Anyone else want to testify in 2007? Please. You didn't sign up. You're supposed to sign the sheet here. You know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lee Hazelwood. I'm a legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission. Sitting here listening to the people interested in taking money out of this settlement. I read the Dash 22 amendment, I think it is. Dash 21 amendment on 2007. The Governor's Commission is naturally interested in elderly and disabled transportation fund. Some people say, how do you stretch this to be a health issue? Seniors cannot get to a doctor.
They need some type of transportation. So we feel we should be in on this plan, and I'm a little bit disappointed in listening to the large amount that Oregon Health Science University wants out of this bill. And I'm not opposed to that because I think it's a great institution. But I still feel that elderly transportation should be part of this bill. So I'm willing to answer any questions. I know that the original intent was $5 million per year. That was in the majority report. With the interest, it wouldn't be quite that much, but it would be a start of the elderly transportation thing. And I know, Mr. Chair, that you've been interested in something of that nature, so I hope we have your support on that.
Okay.
And thank you. I'm willing to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Once you ask me a question for it, so it doesn't feel like...
Kind of to him. Is anybody opposed in this, sir?
Yeah.
Well, then I didn't see the list. Why don't we move the bill out tonight? Why don't we let all the opposition testify and then let's move it out?
Well, there aren't too many people left.
Oh, okay. Well, I can wait a few minutes and move it tonight.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I go to a work session?
I thought we were in one.
Not yet, no. Where are you missing? So we haven't been to that conference with the same thing. We don't know whether the rest of the conference is with us or not.
I still have one question. Okay. Which is, on all of these, or on most of them, there's X percent. It says X percent, but not more than.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it were to generate a larger return then, that would simply be reinvested in the funds. Mm-hmm. That's the expectation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just wanted to check.
We haven't been focused on this particular issue yet, so we want to make sure that we have.
I've already consulted with my conscience, so.
You're okay with it. Okay, we're going to hold the public hearing in 2007, and we're going to join the committee.
We almost made it by today.
And where are you on the other one here?
It's funny. I am going through statute. On 3605, I can't find half of the discussion had to do with statutes. I mean, in looking at it, I was really surprised because I thought what they were saying would be actually correct, and I was.